everyone. Welcome back to Not About the Weather after a fairly long hiatus. It's been around 4 months since we posted an episode, and there are a variety of reasons for that, but it doesn't matter right now because we're here. We will go into that later if necessary, but we are back, and hopefully someone will still get some scrap of enjoyment out of hearing us talk absolute nonsense. A big factor of our situation over the past few months is, lies within our origin story, being that this team here and this podcast identity and this idea sprung from the community of a former podcast that we covered for the TV show Teen Wolf. And in this period that we've been off for Not About the Weather, we had that entire final season of Teen Wolf wrapping up. So all of our leisurely podcast energy was dedicated there for a couple of months, going week by week with Teen Wolf. So that's done now, and we're in that period which we hoped to achieve, which was that once Teen Wolf finished, that we and our friends, Karen, who's not here right now, myself, and our friends could continue to podcast about absolute nonsense within that same community of listeners who've really come to like hanging out with us. So that's what we're doing, and hopefully it'll still be fun. So, hi everyone. This is Not About the Weather. How are you guys today?
Just good.
Fine.
It's our second podcast in a row.
Yes, that's true. So who have we got today? I'm Natalie. We have Mitch. We have Brittany. And we have Caitlin. Hi guys.
Hello.
Hi. And
we certainly all did just record on Rewatchable together, which is another podcast that we do focused on Buffy the Vampire Slayer at the moment. In that, if you're tuning in for the first time, we have a podcast on our parent site, hyperbole.com, which is for rewatching cult shows with a group of newbies and a group of super fans. Not About the Weather also kind of sprung from that environment, in that we waste a lot of everyone's time every episode of Rewatchable talking about absolute nonsense tangents. So in an attempt to stop that happening, we can talk about it over here. That didn't really help in this episode we just recorded, because there were a lot of tangents. A lot. So that's sort of somewhere else that you can listen to us if you want an actual point to the podcast, whereas here we just talk about whatever pop culture that we feel like at the moment. We do have a structure. You'll see. You've either been here before or you pick it up very quickly. You can reach us on the Instagrams and the Twitters and the Facebooks, all of that stuff. Our handle is NATW Podcast on pretty much everything. So that account is shared with the Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was our origin story podcast, which is currently obviously very quiet because Teen Wolf is dead. So our website, where you can find the full show notes and the episodes posted, is notabouttheweatherpodcast.com. You can also follow that as a Tumblr account. And we have a splash page, natwpodcast.com, which is a hub for both of our podcasts, links to our iTunes, Libsyn, Stitcher, whatever. You'll find it. It's all there. You'll find it. Okay. So, very happy to be back. Feel weirdly energized. So this is going to be interesting. And poor Mitch has been gagging for it for months. And another factor of our delay was that we had two live recorded episodes from our time at San Diego Comic-Con, which is obviously quite a while ago, which there were technical issues with those files, or my being able to access those files due to computer failure. And I did not feel comfortable. I got weirdly stuck inside my own head that I didn't want to keep recording unchronologically with old episodes that hadn't yet to be posted. So I got stuck in a rut. I have fixed that now, and you will have heard one of those come out a few days ago, and then there is another one yet to come, which is a full long interview with my friend Nick Lang of Team Starkid. And there's some stuff that we talk about there which is like going to be a little bit dated, in that it's like movies that at the time hadn't come out, which we've now come out. And so it's if you just cast your minds back to like Comic-Con era, It's like a conversation of pop culture at the moment from then with a great, great voice in pop culture who I think that you really enjoy. Last episode, if you've heard it or haven't heard it yet, go back and check that out because it's a clip show. Many, many great people who were at Comic-Con, including I'm not sure if you guys know this, Mike Dante DiMartino, from the creator of Avatar The Last Airbender. We had Charlie Capen, who runs Dishwas for Misha Collins. We had Karen Hallian, the fan artist, who our Karen is really in love with. We had Harry Dixon, who runs the San Diego Comic-Con blog, which she's a really great like voice in that. And we had all sorts. Like it was a really great clip show of people's experiences at Comic-Con, you know, in the form of the hype and the gripe. So I love that episode, and I'm sorry it took so long to come out, but I got really stuck in my own head over I can't keep recording something new when something old isn't posted, and I couldn't access those files. Sorry. We're here. We're getting on with it. So if you haven't been here before, the main format of what we do is a segment called An Obsession to Share and a Grievance to Air, in which everyone brings to the table one thing that they are really stoked on right now and one thing that is really pissing them off right now. That's it. That's the show. Shorthand, we call this a hype and a gripe, something we're hyping, something we're griping this week. And that is what we do with a couple of little bits. And generally that's pop culture related. Sometimes it's bigger world scale. Sometimes it's super personal. So that's what we do. We're going to hang out and do that. And I think this week we're going to start with our negatives. We're going to start with our gripes, and we're going to go on and end with our hypes. So who wants to go first with their gripe?
I'm fine to go ahead if no one else wants to.
I think Mitch and Caitlin both have the most significant big deal current affairs. So one of you two, we should go first.
Want me to warm us up, Caitlin?
Doesn't matter.
Alrighty. So my gripe is I'm confused, J.K. Rowling, and that's the best way I can say that because I want to still love Harry Potter, your universe, you, your writing, your Twitter, everything. And I'm finding that very difficult, and I'm feeling very conflicted very often because over the years you have shown a different face, shown a different side that I don't always appreciate. It feels like Harry Potter is less of that inclusive, happy, safe environment that it has always been for me, the fandom especially. And I wish it would, some of it not always of our fault, but a lot of it from different decisions she's made in plot, or we can say even casting if we needed to. And I wanted to talk about her today because I know she's a little bit in the limelight because of comments she made in a statement about her casting and maintaining of Johnny Depp in The Crimes of Grindelwald, the second Fantastic Beasts movie. So to get us into some of, I guess, the taste and the feel that I'm in right now, I have a quote from, it's kind of, these are minced. I'll say that in advance. So if anything feels extremely out of context, please call me out for it. But I tried to be legitimate about these. A quick introduction to some of her thoughts on the Grindelwald Johnny Depp casting. She wrote, "I accept that there will be those who are not satisfied with our choice of actor in the title role, in our title role." And she goes on to say, "However, conscience isn't governable by committee. Within the fictional world and outside of it, we all have to do what we believe to be the right thing." I found a really good comment that summed up a lot of my feelings about this Johnny Depp thing, so that wouldn't be so much the focus of my gripe. I'll read this from Snatcher Girl 34, or just Snatcher Girl says, this is on a post on Hyperbole that we'll link. It's called Fantastic Beasts, the Johnny Depp casting controversy is about protecting the fandom. Snatcher Girl wrote, "Regardless of what a person has done in the past, it does not make abuse okay. So those condemning Depp and supporting Heard are supporting her as a victim, not an abuser, because in this particular situation, she is the victim. In the court of law, past violations and crimes are irrelevant to the current case. It would actually be a mistrial if a member of the jury was made aware of the prosecutor or defendant's past criminal history. No grown human is actually innocent, but that doesn't make crimes committed against them okay." And that is a lot of how I feel about when J.K. Rowling says this one last quote of, based on our understanding of the circumstances, the filmmakers and I are not only comfortable sticking with our original casting, but genuinely happy to have Johnny playing a major character.
That was the really bizarre sentence to me. That was the thing that I was like, based on our understanding, so based what they have learned about Johnny and Amber, they are not only comfortable sticking with Johnny, they are happy to support and promote Johnny. So their reading of those circumstances, they are implying that their private knowledge of those circumstances or what they've come to believe is something that what they think Johnny is the victim. They think that the public doesn't know the truth or what? Like, I don't, what is that meant to imply, that sentence? I just don't understand.
To me, it's still, it's in the same vein of condescension that I feel like, it almost feels like I know more than you. That makes me in the know.
Oh yeah, that is exactly what it is. That is
in that, that
is
attitude. So this is a cool. So I'm finding my words as I'm talking about it, which I'm so happy I could have this not about the weather talk therapy session as we always do. Mm-hmm. This is a culmination of how I felt about J.K. Rowling's work as of late, probably since Cursed Child, I'd say, and then also of her tweets and her general attitude on social media and or press releases like this. She has an attitude like, I'm right, you're wrong, because I am, period. And it's nasty. It's not the same woman who wrote the story on a napkin, I guess. And she should be transformed. She should be growing. But it's coming into an age where I don't know if I can appreciate her. And I'm right on the cusp here. And I know this sounds like an idle threat, but I feel more comfortable not seeing this movie in the theater because I don't want to support it. I want to see it. I don't want to support it in the mainstream, which is kind of a big deal for me because I've seen every single Harry Potter movie midnight release, period. That was it. Even when I was a kid, I needed to see it, and I'm not doing that. It feels so upsetting, but it makes me feel like I'm finally letting go of my own kind of like form of abuse that I felt from having been so, I've clung on to Harry Potter so long, but I feel like J.K. Rowling wants me to grow up and get out of it.
And she's pushing you out the door with her terrible behavior.
She is, and I think I'm kind of okay with that now. I really do. She's nailing the coffin here, and maybe that's okay. Maybe I'm supposed to feel like that. Maybe she has her works of art, the first seven books, and then she really starts going off the rails, and maybe we all have to recognize that. I don't know. But Natalie, I've heard that you feel very strongly about a lot of the things that I've spoken of. So please take the floor.
Well, this went down pretty badly, obviously, with everyone, all of the writers on Hyperbole, given that site's history with Harry Potter is shocking. There's just absolutely shocking. I don't know. It's really bizarre. The fact that this statement just digs itself so many holes, and I just don't understand why you do it. I don't understand why you just wouldn't say, if you were that determined to keep him, just be like, we are, you know, given the respect, you know, given the request of whatever Johnny and Amber to put this behind it, you know, we're just moving on and carrying on. Why did they say, we thought about recasting but then decided not to? Like, why would you say that? Why would you admit that?
It's a power play, is what it feels like. It's
so bizarre. And in terms of J.K. Rowling, like, we did our Harry Potter special about, like, you know, what people felt about, like, how she'd been behaving since, I don't know, however long. And it's, the more and more this goes on, the more and more she does things, you know, the more I'm like, do you understand what you did the first time around? Like, do you understand, like, are the things that people like about the books or love about the books or have learned about the books, like, were those all intentional or not intentional things? Like, did you craft this intentionally, or have people just sort of made it their own? because I think the value of the books far outstrips, apparently, J.K. Rowling's intentions. Like, and there's several things. Like, I know that sorry to get, like, shippy for a second. But I first started twigging about this when she, you know, started going off, when she sort of turned the tide in the last book and made Remus and Tonks a thing. Mm. And then after that, you know, kind of has never really admitted that, well, not admitted, but I don't want to say admit it, you did it on purpose, if she didn't do it on purpose, but has never really, that it never occurred to her that she was writing that relationship of Sirius and Remus as inherently queer, like as absolutely like them, that relationship was that kind of partnership, especially when she did say that she wrote Remus's story as an AIDS metaphor, like literally. And I'm like, how did you not put the two and two together and understand how that was being read? Or like, did you understand and then decide not to? Like, I am not a tin hatter in terms of shipping, and you know, there's a lot of conversation about that at the moment, but I am not someone who goes out looking for things to be desperately, you know, fan theory, whether that's being gay or whether that's whatever. I only really notice or start believing that kind of stuff when I feel like it hits me so hard that it must be intentional. I'm not like out there digging for it. And I was just so astounded by her apparent obliviousness to what she'd done when it felt so obvious to so many people. And then sort of that sort of has just built up and built up and built up that she has done this about everything. She's done this about everything, not, you know, about characters, about, you know, backstory, about worlds that, you know, the all of the new stuff that she's producing. I just don't know if her intentions were ever apparently the thing that people were really taking away for the book. So that what I'm saying there is that for all that I actually generally, and this is not a great thing as any kind of literary critic, I do not believe in death of the author. Author intention means a lot to me. If I'm like, that's how the author intended it to be read, that is what I care about. Or like, you know, I care about authors confirming canon off screen or whatever. I'm actually a really big person for that. Some people hate that. Some people are like, no, it's what it means to me and that's it. I don't believe in death of the author, except when it comes to J.K. Rowling. At this moment, I am just like, nope, books aren't yours anymore. They're ours. Go away. Just stop talking, yeah. And just go away, because it's just, and I don't think she's a bad person. Mm-mm. I just don't know what she's doing. I just don't know, like, why don't you just stop, like, just stop. And I really didn't think it was going to get to this level with Grindelwald and these movies, like with Fantastic Beasts and Johnny Depp. I can't believe they cast him in the first place, just because I just don't think he's a good fit for this universe, even if he was not having these problems and accusations, yeah, and court cases. I just don't think he's a good fit for this universe.
Well, I think some could argue against you there, only to say that a lot of people would say a lot of the best Brits have been in the Potter movies, save for Johnny Depp. And like him or not, he's done a lot of great roles.
He's not British.
Right?
He's not British.
Oh my God, he's not. No, that was so stupid. No, but that's funny that you would. I swear I've heard people say that before, and I don't know why I would have bought into it so easily.
Why on earth?
That's weird. What? No. Nah. It must be not something kind of common to people think he's British. I don't think I'm alone in that.
No, I don't know. He's played a lot of weird things, but
yeah, maybe it's the roles he plays in.
You could have had anyone. You could have had anyone. You could have kept Colin Farrell, for God's sake. You could have made that work. You could have been like, oh yeah, that I liked how I looked then, so that's just how I'm
gonna. Yeah,
you
know, like easily.
You could have kept Colin Farrell. You could have had anyone. And Grindelwald was meant to be beautiful as well. Like, that being said, like, not, like, weird and old and scary and yellow-haired and, like, he was meant to be, you know.
And look, Jude Law would never be attracted to that. Let's just put that
there.
I say, I'm like insulted on Dumbledore's
back. Yeah,
I know.
Anyway, and I don't care about Dumbledore that much.
No, I don't really like. Jude Law might be able to make me care because I love Jude Law as a human being and find his characters very anger inducing. Oh, he plays a lot of characters that make me very angry about. Like he affects me a lot. Like, he pisses me off on screen a lot, but he's an awesome person. So I am curious about what his Dumbledore's going to be like, of course. And so I would, you know, love to be able to see that. But what the hell is going on? I don't know.
Natalie, it's be nervous. Absurd. Be very nervous here because, I mean, walk with trepidation for the fact that we don't know if she's even going to write in them actually being gay together in this movie. She could retcon that. She could ignore it. I don't know. I don't really know if I care anymore because I'm like, if Dumbledore needs to be your gay character because you feel better about that, that's great. It doesn't feel like it was really written in. I think she kind of shoved it in. I'm of the camp that I do think that she told it after the fact, and I don't know why. And that does seem to be the issue, as you're saying, Natalie, that she doesn't know what she's doing with her book. She's just randomly throwing things out because that was such a random throwing out. It was the original interview. She was in a great hall, and she said it to I think it was just like offhand to like a child who asked a question or something. I don't know, whatever it was.
Yeah, it was. It was at a talk after the series.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, for sure. And she was just like, does Dumbledore have a wife or, you know, any history of him? And she was like, actually, I always considered Dumbledore as gay. And everyone was like, yay. And then a few years later, or like as everyone like socially progressed or whatever, everyone's like, wait a minute. If you believed that the whole time, why did you not include anything to that to that leaning in the books? As I mean, I did suspect it from Grindelwald when I read the seventh book. I was like, "Yep," and sort of was like, that's what I vibe in that situation with that relationship.
But you've been burned before.
But I've been burned before. Exactly. And I'm like, really?
I don't expect you to be unburnt
and then you wrote Dumbledore and Grindelwald and you don't, like, you literally think that was that and that was not that. Okay, whatever. But yes, so I definitely suspected it, but at first it's like, oh, okay, Dumbledore. And then secondly, like, oh, well, this doesn't help. What about in, 20 years when some kid who doesn't know about this interview reads these books, that helps zero amount unless it is textually in there. But anyway, that's not the point. I'm curious about the others and their response to this particular drama and J.K. Rowling's sort of behavior about the Potterverse in general. I mean, it's something we've certainly discussed before, but this is a new low.
I think a big part of it for me was, everyone, when the pictures came out and it just like, it reinvited this wave of why are you still keeping this? Why are you insisting that this is a thing? And, while you wait for someone's reaction and you want their statement, with her, I didn't want it. And when I refused to click on it for a good solid day.
Really?
I just was like, it's not going to be good. I've come to expect that. Like, I kind of want her. It's like, I want her to just stop speaking. I also feel that way about Pottermore too. Like, I don't read anything new on Pottermore. I never have because it drives me crazy. And I think, Natalie, you said something earlier, like, these books aren't hers anymore, and they're not. They've gone way beyond her. And I think that the fan community and just individually, like to whatever the books mean to an individual person themselves, have done so many things with them that are so personal that to have her keep coming in and like ruining that, it's sort of, yes, you gave us this. Like, yes, we are eternally grateful in so many ways. But at the same time, it's like, okay, just stop. Please stop. or think or see how this is affecting someone. I just can't understand how she could, or anyone at the studio. I know authors don't control casting. That's a huge thing. Authors do not control casting. She kind of does have a bit of a power in her movie.
Oh, this
with David Gage, she's buddy buddy enough that she can tell you.
This one, she could have
exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, there's her name is slipping my mind right now, but the Hate U Give author. She has like her Twitter handle right now reads like, "I'm not in charge of casting my movies."
Yeah.
John Green speaks about it a lot. He's like, his Twitter bio says, "I do not control the casting of my movies."
Yeah. Maggie Steven is just starting to get the same thing with the Raven cycle going into production. Not that that has any casting yet, but she's already being like, cause people spam her with like, "I want this hot guy to play whoever, you know?"
Yeah. And but JK, I feel like, you know what? You kind of do.
Oh, she, for Beasts, 100%.
Yeah.
Like, 100%. Maybe not for the original series, but for this, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She is in the room where it happens. Absolutely.
So, it's hard to, you know.
She's culpable.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the most culpable. She has to be, because she has such power, and that she's let that power go to her head here with, especially the, once again, the line that is driving both of us crazy, Natalie. It's based on our understanding of the circumstances. The filmmakers and I are not only comfortable sticking with our original casting, but genuinely happy.
As in, based on our understanding of the circumstances, we are happy to... Yeah, so maybe their understanding of the circumstances is what, that they don't believe it or that they don't care or what? Like, I don't, like...
And this is on top of the fact that Johnny Depp in general has been known to be a not good person on set, to not show up, to not do the things. I don't know if that's too much of a hidden thing. I've heard in my own right, my own circles of people who have talked to or been with or whatever and have found it to be highly unpleasant. That's neither here nor there. I know we're talking more about the J.K. Rowling element to this all. And this is where I feel we're reaching the Phantom Menace point where George Lucas needs to be taken out back to pasture. We need to let her not do this anymore. So I think maybe she needs to pass off the series to someone else. They can do it better because they're outside of it.
Look at how good, and this is something that, again, if you listen to the Clip Show episode that will have been posted directly before this, Charlie, who is a friend of mine who is involved with, as I said, Gishwas and Random Acts, and he used to do PR for Netflix and Marvel shows and stuff. Anyway, talking about that, like, the Star Wars movies are better than ever, in my opinion, because... It's not the original creator who's gone crazy with his own power driving the vision. It's fans. It's people who Gareth Edwards and J.J. Abrams and Rian Johnson are all insane fans who care about what this meant to them. And so they know what it means to something else. Rogue One, you know, for all, some people didn't like it. I did, but it is perfect. It's fan fiction in the best possible way. And I would rather that some fan at Lucas or Fox or Warner Brothers was like, "Hey, J.K. Rowling, I'm going to make some beautiful, beautiful fan fiction of your creation into films, and they're going to feel like why fans love them, because I understand, because you clearly don't anymore."
Like, but Cursed Child was fan fiction.
But she still her story.
She signed off on it, but she didn't write it. That's what I'm saying. I still feel like she's too much of an influence there. She needs to totally get out of the process at this point. She needs to save her series by not being in it.
I don't know.
She'll never give up those keys. I know she won't. And part of me says that she's right in not giving up those keys. But the other half of me is like, I want good Potter again, and I want you to not ruin it for me anymore. Because you are.
Why would I be okay if it just stopped?
I would be so happy if Cursed Child never happened. Fantastic Beasts is just all right. It's not the originals. It's never going to be for me.
I will take Cursed Child with Jamie Parker over Fantastic Beasts with Johnny Depp.
Fair enough. I'm not talking cast. I'm talking plot. And her influence there is just what's making me... She needs to stop. She's on a crazy drain. I think she's on a power trip and she won't get off of it unless someone really close to her tells her that she's not doing the right things for her series anymore or for mankind, because my God, she's upsetting me so much and she doesn't even know me. That's a big deal.
That's what gets me is who thought that that was the right statement to put out? Mm-hmm. Like, I could see like her writing it, but someone should have read that and gone, maybe we shouldn't put this out. This maybe doesn't send the best message. Like, how did they think that was going to be well received?
I have no idea. It's when I read it, I was like, when I saw the headline, when she said, the comment on Johnny Depp, I thought it was going to be where Christopher Plummering it, you know, where we're reshooting, or I thought it was going to be like, he's there, but we're trapped. I fully thought she was going to blow the lid off because she has the power to blow the lid off and be like, you know, what are they going to do? Fire her? Like, she's got all the money, like, and it's her project. So I thought that they were going to be like, yep. I thought she, few moments, I thought she was going to blow the lid off the whole thing. But so to sit, read this and come crashing down was absolutely huge.
I find it precious that you'd feel that way, that you thought she was going
just
to.
Just for a
really.
Second.
My sweet summer child,
for a second.
No.
I'm sorry.
I've said all my piece on J.K. Rowling. Caitlin, I don't know if you want to say any more. I didn't hear too much from you yet, but are you feeling, everyone else feeling that piece? Kate, do you have anything more about J.K. Rowling in general? Your feelings over the years, have they changed?
I mean, I couldn't help but think during this that this is the woman that wanted us to feel bad for Severus Snape, so maybe we shouldn't be that surprised.
Oh, that's a burn, and I love it.
Interesting take.
It's a burn that we need to move on from because Snape is
sorry. Oh, no. Yes, you're a Snape lover.
He's not the time or place for that conversation.
I think that's a different conversation about the fact that for all intents and purposes, it worked for a lot of people, like that she did make people feel sorry for him, and that is whether that sheer fact of that story being sympathized in that way is a problem or if it's valid. Anyway, not for today. So do we want to go into even worse real world problems, or do we want to go into more fictional land at the moment? What do we want to talk about next?
Stay in the real world.
Yeah, Caitlin, do you want to go next then?
We'll rip it off like a band-aid.
Yeah.
So I moved right into the political range because I live one state over from Alabama, so I can't get away from this shit. Mm. The election between Roy Moore and Doug Jones is just about to occur, and Roy Moore cannot keep from saying stupid things. He has, you know, let's run down all the stupid shit he said and then talk about the stupid thing he said today. And
oh, what date is the election?
It is the 12th, December 12th.
Okay, so it's now the 10th. This might have happened by the time you hear this, but we'll see. So fingers crossed. But anyway, carry on.
So he was removed from the bench as a judge because he tried to put up a monument to the Ten Commandments at the State House. And when he was told not to do that because, you know, separation between church and state, he refused. Yeah. He was kicked out. He has tried to run for political office before and has gotten his butt handed to him. He doesn't believe in evolution. He doesn't think that Muslims should be allowed to hold office. He thinks homosexuality is a sin and that 9/11 was America's punishment for tolerating homosexuality. Oh, and then there's, of course, just the fact that he's a pedophile. And his campaign just keeps doubling down on that, well, of course the accusations aren't true, even though you just keep hearing more and more of them. But the rumor is that he was banned from a mall because he was trolling for teenage girls in his 30s when he was already the district attorney. And there are stories of teenage girls that he offered a ride home to. And, you know, when you're 16, you'd think you could trust the freaking district attorney. Mm-hmm. Instead, he would try and grope them and lock the doors in the car.
I saw a video the other day of some brilliant folk, I assume, discussing this. And I think it was like a BuzzFeed video that was like reporting on something else in it, because the article was not supporting this view. But it was like a clip of people discussing this issue. And it was saying something like, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago in Alabama, you know, any parents would be happy to have their 14-year-old girl, you know, have a potential match with the district attorney, like that kind of, literally that kind of thing. Like, yeah, it's the South, like, you know, it's the South. And, you know, my grandmother was married at 13, two kids by 15. And this is like, this would, you know, this is a culture where that would be like a great thing for some families. And I was just like, really, really, like, that's your take, that's your take on this.
It's so, really yeah. disgusting. And then he decided today, December 10th, oh, no, a couple days ago, an African-American was at one of his town halls, asked when he thought times were better.
Oh, fuck. Roy Moore sorry, this is not a family-friendly podcast, by the way. We do swear, and I'm going to say, fuck this shit. This was fucking insane. Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
So he said, I think it was great at the time when families were united. Even though we had slavery, they cared for one another. Our families were strong. Our country had a direction.
What does that even mean? What does that even mean? What families have been united since the fall of slavery. Families are still united today. What the fuck does that mean, Roy Moore? What are you trying to imply here? Like, are you talking about the American, the African-American slaves and the white plantation owners as a family together? Like, when we were all united working together, even though I owned you? Is that what you mean? I don't understand. Like,
he doesn't like black people. Let's just... He's racist. He's a massive racist. And then it gets better. So today, the 10th, he said in an interview that it would be better that if we got rid of all the amendments after the 10th. Those are the amendments that did things like ended slavery, gave African Americans the right to vote, gave women the right to vote, called for, you know, equal protection under the law.
How can anyone genuinely stand up in public and feel shameless about saying these things? I just don't understand. Is there enough of a culture that is like, what validates someone? What makes someone think that they can stand up and say those things without being arrested? Like, how is, I mean, yes, freedom of speech, whatever. But like, how does someone think that those views are like something that is in any way, like, does he realize it's not socially acceptable? Like, just like, I just don't understand. Like, does he realize that like there is a base level of equality and human rights, no matter how many people keep trying to fight it, but that, you know, you can't, I would have assumed that everyone that is outright this prejudiced kind of knows that they have to keep it under the table. Obviously, that's not true because look at where we are in the world right now. But it just shocks me every single time. It shocks me and I can't understand it.
It should. Shock you.
These are the people who kept it under the table before Donald Trump was president.
Yes, I know. It's so...
But he hasn't really kept it under the table because he's been this crazy all along. And he was, the thing is, he was crazy even for Alabama until this year. Because he has run for office multiple times and been soundly defeated. So it's only this year that he's really gotten traction. And he's probably going to win. And that's just...
Really? How? How? Why? Because all of the people who were keeping it under the table now feel like they can be validated. Is that
There's Alabama is such a red state that there are people who
vote party over person.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
There's also a very strong evangelical population that doesn't care, and they like that he's a religious fanatic.
I did hear some tossing around that the Virgin Mary was 14, so therefore Roy Moore is chill. I did hear that as well.
Oh my God.
Yeah, really, I did hear that. So sorry, please.
That is mind blowing.
Yep. So
like, how dare they? No.
Yep. Please carry on. I literally saw, I think, someone's tweet being like, get their names as in like Mary and Jesus out of your mouth. Like, how dare you compare that to...
Like, thousands of years of social progress and societal advancement mean nothing to these humans?
Apparently not.
14 yep. that long ago is not the same 14 as today.
Yes, period. You and I, all sane people, know this. But yes, please carry on.
Oh my God, that one really boils me. That's insane. That's like extreming. That's taking so many different extremes all at once and just like mashing them up into one horrible pile. Ugh.
It's everything is awful. And as someone who was born and raised for much of my life in the South, I am embarrassed to say that when this kind of thing comes up, because it just makes it look like if you are from the South, you are this much of a redneck and a hick. And I am just horrified to be one state over from this bullshit. Everything is just awful, and it literally makes me sick to my stomach.
It's very hard to process how this is legitimately, truthfully happening, that people are getting up and saying these kind of things in public like they have the right to. I mean, technically, they have the right to say whatever they want, but, like, at what cost, you know? Like, seriously, it's like, oh, it's just no common sense about anything.
Apparently he said this thing about the getting rid of the amendments after the 10th in 2011, but it's getting play.
It's coming out now, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But
I mean, Natalie, if you needed to understand, maybe you do, because I know that you speak to Americans very often, that it's come to the point where my daily life feels like that dog who is, this is fine with the fire. always.
Yeah,
that's accurate.
I can see the picture. Yeah, it's just.
My mother lives a little more rural, not like super rural, but like a little over an hour outside of Atlanta. And on the road to her house, there's a house that has a flag in their yard that is half American flag, half Confederate flag. I've never seen that before.
That is disgustingly creative. How dare they?
I was horrified to see that.
Isn't it illegal? I assume it's not illegal to fly the Confederate flag.
No.
No. Maybe it should be.
It's tough, Natalie. It's not fun. I'll give you that much. While we do have faster internet here, that's just about our only advantage right now.
Yeah.
I just want to be like, hashtag not all Southerners. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I believe you. I don't know. It's just, it's very bizarre. I don't know about the cause and effect that leads to that worldview in an area, like whether it is still that Civil War divide hangover, or if it is what it is that has led to that, if it is the religious aspect, or, you know, how this builds to be the worldview of a whole community. I don't really understand, because you aren't like that. Lots of people aren't like that. Like, I just, you know, how does that become the norm? I don't really get it.
What always amazes me visiting anywhere in the South is that it's not like there is not a minority population there. There is.
There is. It's just super, like, oppressive and segregated, I must assume. Like,
somewhat. It can be, yeah, definitely. In terms of, I mean, you could probably speak more to this, Caitlin. I won't take your place there. In terms of, I'm sure, like, housing and jobs, like, yeah. I'm sure there's still some form of segregation going on with a lot of different areas.
I mean, yes. A lot of it is income inequality and where people can afford to live.
Yeah.
But, you know, the South is very heavily Black. Georgia, where I live, very diverse. But with Republicans in charge, they have gerrymandered the shit out of congressional districts to make it so the majority of minority populations that are going to vote Democrat all fall in these really messed up, twisted districts.
Yeah.
And then you get all the conservatives.
So their vote isn't spread over enough to make power. Yeah. Oh my God.
I think the strangest thing about this all too is that I don't know if this is me becoming an adult or whatnot, but it feels like I did not hear as much about politics or need to, especially amongst things that I considered pure entertainment up until we had Donald Trump as president or the election. It felt like the world awakened all at once to how horrible all of this is, but it let it continue at the same time. So this is like this continuing issue that doesn't make sense to me. It's kind of like the J.K. Rowling thing. It's like, how is this still happening in a poor way? I mean, of course, she's in a much smaller scale in terms of morals. But regardless, this is still like a big freaking deal for the world. And even if this isn't a presidential election, this matters for the way a lot of laws and the world will develop. It's terrifying. Like, I almost feel like we're in some kind of AU still. It doesn't make sense. This still feels like a dreamland.
I don't know. I saw a fantastic, well, not fantastic, but a ridiculous, humorous tweet the other day where it was like, maybe the rapture did actually happen, but David Bowie was the only person worthy who got to go.
And Carrie Fisher. You can say Carrie Fisher as well. She waited a little bit.
Oh my God. Anyway, this is insane. I wish you the best of luck. And well, I do. Like, I don't mean that facetiously. Like, I really hope that I never thought that I would know this much about a state. Is it Congress or Senate? Election. What is he running for exactly?
Senate, which is one house of Congress.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Never thought I'd know this much about an individual state Senate election in a country that I don't live in, but this is not even close to the first I've heard of this. This is world news. Like, yeah, this is just, I just can't believe this is like, I wish I didn't have to know this much about other countries' politics. I wish everyone was just freaking moderate, at least, just moderate, just be a common sense level of sane, and then we can just all chill out a little bit. And it's just insane. I don't know. I just can't.
Insane is the right word for it.
I don't know. I can't. It's just completely insane, and I cannot imagine what it is like to be in the environment of it like that. So yeah. Just completely nuts.
It's very stressful.
Yeah. Well, I really hope that, you know, something fantastic happens to change that. But I don't know what the likelihood of that is. So, yeah. I've certainly seen all the support in the world for Doug Jones, but I don't really, you know, follow anyone. Like, I curate, you know, my experience online, and no one that I would have anything to do with is obviously for this. So all I've seen much talk of Doug Jones, but I don't know how that relates to the actual population of Alabama. Probably not great.
And it's really hard for them to know because, they're pretty sure that a lot of people would just lie about who they were going to vote for because they're embarrassed. Mm. And B, they almost never poll Alabama because it always goes Republican. So they don't have a good metric for getting that information. So it's really hard to figure out what's going to happen. So it's just, everything's messy and scary, and I'm just bracing for Roy Moore winning and everything being continually awful.
Oh, well, I really hope it doesn't come to that. Like, I just don't understand. Is there no clause? Is there nothing in place to say you are too extreme to represent people in general? Is there nothing that
45 proved that was not
that's true? I suppose that's true, but like, I just like, as in like, there it is, like, as in like, you know, we're calling it like, you are too crazy, therefore
the Senate can refuse to seat him, but it will take,
they probably won't.
It would take a bunch of Republicans
to cross the floor.
Yeah, and they really want a Republican vote to get things done.
This is insane. Okay. Oh, this is insane. I don't know. Sorry, everyone. This is a fun time in the world that we're experiencing. We've got some great things to talk about as well, but this is just completely nuts. So I really hope that anyone who has any control or power in any situation, even similar to this, do something to oppose anything like this in your area. Anything like this in any election that ever comes up, or anyone who is being given this kind of platform when they are just clearly not equipped for it. So I don't know, just, it's nuts. Okay. I'm gonna lighten it up a bit. I'm gonna go next because I'm gonna get really angry about Brittany's one as well. So I'm gonna go next just because mine is just a little bit of a respite from full rage. My gripe this week is the movie that's coming out called The Greatest Showman. And I'll tell you why this is my gripe. This is my gripe because everything about this movie should make it the greatest movie that I've ever seen. Everything about this is perfect. It's Hugh Jackman in a musical theater role. Music is written by Pasek and Paul. It's a beautiful period drama. Zac Efron, who I love, is in it. And Michelle Williams, Zendaya. I love all of these people. And the music sounds great from what I've heard. And it, you know, it's a circusy, period drama thing. I want to be able to see this movie and love it. But what the frickety frack are they doing making a hero plot movie about P.T. Barnum? I do not know how much anyone knows about P.T. Barnum, but he is the greatest showman, as they mentioned. He kind of popularized the modern circus, but he's known for being a crook, and not only for being a crook, for being an exploiter. Like he popularized the sideshow. Like he would take people like what they'd call midgets, or they'd take, you know, people with birth defects, or people with, from other countries, like tribal people or whatever, and literally like parade them around like sideshow culture. Go in and see the freaks or whatever. And I will admit that I do not know too much. I've heard very vague opposing views that at the time, if you were, you know, say someone who was disabled or disfigured or something like that, that you know, within that circus culture, you could find like a lot of freedom and you could make money and make a lot of power. And when there were no other opportunities available to you. That being said, I'm still very no on this movie and on the many records of P.T. Barnum's history and the kind of people that he exhibited and the way that he treated them. It's obviously completely different culture, completely different time of what was acceptable, you know, politically correct, you know. But I still find it bizarre. I don't know how softened this movie is going to be. I don't know if this movie is going to turn around and be like, yeah, here's all the dodgy shit and actually acknowledge it, because it seems like it's played like a full, beautiful, that he's a beautiful dreamer and that it's a hero's story. And I find this completely nuts. And I just wanted to ask Brittany, because obviously you're very down with the musical theatre. Do you know anything about this that can like in any way redeem this for me?
I'm going to have to say I don't know much about it, but watching TV this weekend, I saw the preview about 9,000 times, and it really sets him up as, at least from the trailer. I haven't looked into the music or anything yet, mainly because I want to see it.
I want to see it as well, but I'm just like, what is going on? Yeah.
But you know, he's set up as a family man.
Yeah.
Being this, I think what they're going to do is the same thing that they did with Freak Show, where it's, oh, I'm creating a place of refuge. Mm. This is where you can come to be with a family, people who care about you. It's not about exploitation. It's about inclusion and putting on a show. But then again, he's like, because like, you know, in all the clips and stuff, I saw a newer one today that I hadn't seen. He's like, you know, riding in on an elephant, and you know, it's very much, I think, about him and gathering these people, you know, not so much the darker side of what happened after he gathered the people. Mm. But I have a feeling it's going to be the lead up to the first show and not the fallout of everything after.
Interesting. Yeah. Cause there's definitely, you know, I honestly don't know the truth of it, but you've definitely got one hand that would say behind closed doors, you know, he was really great to, you know, these people he created a place for. And then behind, you know, the other hand, you've got this was absurd exploitation that made these people's lives hell. I mean, it's not like society was an awesome place for anyone who might end up in a sideshow regardless, but it's, I don't know, it's just really strange, and I want to see it and I want to enjoy it, but I find it really strange that this is the take that they decided to write this story about, that it's kind of a, you know, beautiful, sanitized thing. I kind of feel similar about like the Walt Disney like Mary Poppins movie with Tom Hanks and was it Emma Thompson, because that was also, I mean, that did not have the same levels of, you know, human exploitation in it, but that was also like a weirdly sympathized story of a story that to my knowledge was not that sympathized. So I guess my real gripe is like, besides from this specific movie I desperately would love to be able to love, this sympathizing of characters and of real people, and why we do that and how that affects history and how that affects, I guess, how that affects what we'll forgive in people, like, you know, what we'll excuse. Obviously there's 2, 3, 5,000 sides to every story, but how much should some stories be sympathized? I just saw The Man Who Invented Christmas, the Charles Dickens biopic about writing A Christmas Carol. Absolutely loved it, actually. I completely loved it.
I'm going to see that, I think, on Christmas this year.
I completely loved it, but I was kind of like, I feel like Charles Dickens was not this likable or nice. I think that he was a dick. And I know his history. I know his own, Charles Dickens' own personal history, which is that his, you know, it's part of the story. He kept secret, you know, the reason that he wrote about the working classes the way he did is because he was forced into the workhouse when his father was in a debtor's prison to pay off his debt. I've been to the Charles Dickens house in London. But his character in the movie is adorable. He's wonderful. It's Dan Stevens.
Well, it's Dan Stevens.
I love him. And I'm just like, I don't think he was this nice. But anyway, the point is, this. If we're telling history, I would like it to be as truthful as possible while still, you know, for entertainment. And if someone is really that problematic, to weigh up the benefits of sanitizing them and what that might imply, like as opposed to just writing and not maybe a fictional story based on that kind of circumstance about someone who isn't historically evil or, you know, a dick. So I'm just sort of curious as well, like to flip this around on you guys. Have you guys ever had any experiences like that with maybe like a biography or something like that where something has been either absurdly sanitized or absurdly vilified that you know was not really the truth, but it has created an opinion about it that is not maybe accurate, like really inaccurate, like that someone has popularized a story in a way that's just not really true?
About, does Christopher Columbus count?
In a bio. Well, yes, I'd say that one. That one would count. Yeah. Yeah, very, very true. Where, you know.
Person, story, not director, but.
Yes, yes. You mean literally Christopher Columbus, the. Yes, I think that's.
Did you think I meant the Harry Potter director?
No, I thought you meant the real person, and then I thought you meant the director for a second, and then
I do mean the real person.
We're back on the same page. Yes, you're talking about the Christopher Columbus, the hero of discovering America versus Christopher Columbus, the crazy rapist and stuff. Yeah.
Oh God. Fair. I'm talking about the man that massacred many that were living peacefully because that was his goal.
Yeah. Oh, there's tons and tons, like not just in the USA, like in what he did in other islands that were colonized and stuff like that is insane. The Christopher Columbus story, once you start digging into it, of course.
But we still get off for school and work for it.
Yeah.
It's disturbing every year. And Thanksgiving is its whole other beast because of that. It's like, oh. It's yeah, family strange. Though.
It's very strange. So, Brittany and Caitlin, have you had this like with anyone that, you know, you've been like, that's probably not what happened, and that's kind of disturbing that that's what we think happened?
I'm trying to think of anything I've actually even watched recently that would have. I don't know.
I know if it doesn't spring to mind, it's no big deal. It's just this Greatest Showman is really hammering that home for me at the moment, that I'm like, because as soon as I saw it, I'm like, should I be asking any questions here? And then I saw a few people talking about it, but like, I'm like, Pasek and Paul, like they're not stupid. They're socially aware people. I don't, like, I'm like, I've got some questions about what you're doing here. Maybe the movie is going to go really dark unexpectedly. We don't know. Maybe it will address it. But I don't know. I was just really confused. And I do want to see it, but I'm very confused. And, yeah. But I'm curious, listeners as well, if there's anything out there that you're like, here's the facts and here is the fictional biography that everyone knows, or the story that has been sold to us about someone. Christopher Columbus is an amazing example. I like not to like shit all over everything that everyone likes, but
is that our question of the day, or did we get one in?
Oh, I've got one. Ooh. No, I've got a question of the day. But I do value the truth of stories, and sometimes the truth is a lot more interesting as well. So. Anyway, all right, let's move on from that to Brittany's gripe, which is also my gripe, but Brittany.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You kick it off.
It's just something I've been very angry about. And so at Hypable, we've been writing a lot of end of year blurbs, and you know, it's asking you to think back on some of like the greatest things that happened this year. And one of the greatest things that happened this year involved Natalie, and it was spread out over like weeks. And I feel like it was something that brought Nat and I to just a really cool place in our working relationship that we've never explored before. And it was a really great time as a fan of Neil Gaiman and American Gods. So yeah. American Gods happened this year, and it far and beyond exceeded every expectation that I had for this show. And it, Natalie and I did these recaps where we would watch the episode once or maybe even twice and then just have a conversation. And those conversations for a 55-minute episode lasted 2 or more hours and for every single one, and tens of thousands of words were written between us on these episodes because it was like Brian Fuller and Michael Green, who were co-showrunners on the show, they were writers, they were involved in every single, their fingerprints are as all over this project as are the actors and Neil Gaiman's. They like, it was like they almost reached into a part of our soul, pulled something out and put it on screen in the perfect form. And it just, it's painful to talk about because a few weeks ago, I think it was only last week.
It was a week ago.
Yeah, it was a week. This year has been really long if you haven't been able to
tell. So much has happened. The world has just already ended since then, you know, like.
Yeah. So Brian Fuller and Michael Green have exited the show, and it was like not even a balloon deflating of my enthusiasm and anticipation for next season. It just popped with one line, Brian Fuller, Michael Green exit American Gods. That's it. It's like sort of like, well, that's the end, because these two people, sitting in a room with them, I got to go to the press event in New York, and sitting in a room with these two people, hearing them talk about this book, hearing every single cast member talk about Brian Fuller and Michael Green and this book, hearing Neil Gaiman talk about Brian Fuller and Michael Green and their connection to this piece of art, you just felt so happy and like it was safe in their hands, and now it's gone. Reason citing budget disputes. It costs a lot of money to make something as visually beautiful as American Gods. And that was something that also happened with Hannibal. The budgets weren't able to be met as well for what Brian wanted to do, but we saw what he did and it was incredible, and still not over Natalie getting me into that mess, but you know.
I just don't really understand, like, this. Well, no, and that's the thing. I have to be very careful what I say here, because you know that I've spoken to Neil about this as well, and I don't know how much of that is public. So, but it was very hard for him to find someone who he would trust with this, and the problem is, you know, is Brian, you know, Brian and Michael are his friends. They were working on the story together and all that kind of stuff. So he gets Brian and Michael, you know, they get Fremantle, they cut a deal. I don't know which came first about the Brian and the Michael. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have gone ahead without the vision of the creators who were going to create it. They found the network. They shot, you know, they had it. They had it all in place. So Brian and Michael leave, and now you've got Neil stuck in a. And this, I'm not quoting him here. I'm talking about the theory of this, just to be very, very clear to anyone listening. But you have Neil stuck in a contract with a network without the linchpin that made him agree to sell the project in the first place, and that is very stressful for me. If you know what I mean. So it's not, he can now not, if he, even if he wanted to, take his toys and go away, because he has made the deal already to have it optioned, to have it belong to Fremantle Media on Stars. And so you've got author and network without the piece in the middle that was the only reason the author felt comfortable going ahead.
Mm-hmm.
That is shockingly bad. And he is, you know, said that he's, you know, hopeful to work as closely with the next showrunners as Brian and Michael. But that is the origin of the situation, is that he put it into the hands and hearts of these people, and that's why the show worked for him. And he's had his works optioned and, you know, attempted to be made millions of times, and he says no a lot. Like, so this is, it's not good. And I don't know what has, and if it's money, I'm also like, guys, like, yes, you had, maybe you had bigger dreams, and but the budget for season two was already bigger than the budget you were getting per episode for season one, and season one was great. Like, you could have done it for the same, like, if it had been the same, even if you wanted to top yourself, you could have done it for the same quality. It could have plateaued, and it still would have been better than anything else on television.
Yeah, like, and so honestly, like, I think, like, between our discussions and stuff, and the best moments were the moments that didn't have anything huge or flashy,
like crazy CGI, literally, like just driving in a car, you know? Yeah. Like,
it was like, it was such basic stuff. The conversation that he has in jail, and the airport, and the, when he's cleaning the house, like, those scenes were the ones that we talked about so much. And it was just like Ricky Whittle in a white t-shirt, which, still, if they optioned that t-shirt for sale, I would buy 100 of them.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just a bizarre situation. I was so shocked. Like, I was just, I thought everything was fine. They had a, you know, great relationship. I believe that even one of the network execs left the network, left Fremantle to be an EP on American Gods because they believed in it that hard. Like, he changed his allegiance, not right now, like, not in this mess, but, like, last year, Craig Sigalini, like, Sigaleski, I think, was a Fremantle rep who is now an American Gods producer person, or maybe he's not after this shift. But there was, the, across the board, from author to create show creators to production company to network, it was candy. Everyone was having the time of their life. So positive. So I just don't know what the final straw is. I don't know if it was like the first article that came out, because I don't believe Brian and Michael have yet made a statement. I don't believe.
No, they haven't. I looked again before we recorded.
The phrasing of the first release sounds like it was a leak, as in someone has leaked that this is something that they are doing or wanting to do. So even if it was only a theory, even if they were in negotiations and it could have been saved, that they could have cut a deal or they could have changed their minds, this leak comes out and it forces everyone's hand. And so that is also horrific. Like, it's just a ridiculous circumstance of horribleness, and what they prioritized for the show, what they weren't willing to hold back on, like, that there are other things I wish I could, and I don't, like, I love these men, like, I genuinely, they're two of my favorite creators, both separately and together.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that I could be like, the stuff that you fought for that was the most important shouldn't have been about the money, because you also fought for the stuff like the expansion of the roles of characters like Laura and Bilquis. You fought for the stuff with the gin. You fought for all of these things that are not actually dependent on money. And I don't understand what it was that you thought you weren't going to be able to do for that money, if that's the issue.
Yeah.
The budget was like $10 million an episode for this.
Yeah, season. It was something, it was astronomical. Like, when I saw that they were asking for more, I was like, ah.
There's got to be more to it. Like, I don't. Yeah.
Because I don't, if that is the case, okay. I will be angry about that on their, like, against them.
Them. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But if it's something deeper, you gotta say something, because it that is not the hill I want to be fighting up against if it's not true. If there's something more, then there's something more. But yeah, and it's not helping Brian at all, because this is just a bad year for him in terms of
not the first time. It's not the first time. It's not even the second or the third time. So,
and
like, even if, it's not even the first time this year.
Exactly.
Brian. Like, yeah.
And this is like, he left Star Trek to do this, which is fine. But, like, you know, then you're like, oh, but like, I'd read a couple of, like, tweets from, like, random people who were like, oh, well, can't stick to anything. Like, you know, like, I'm just like, oh, but I feel like that's not Brian. But maybe it is, and I'm getting to know Brian Fuller, but I don't want to believe that just because of Hannibal.
Well, I mean, I know Neil. Like, this is the thing, and I don't know if anyone's listening to this for the first time. It's not a secret. He's a good friend of mine. Our friendship in the last couple of years has passed casual to close. I talk to him at the moment more frequently than I talk to my own father, which is no offense to my father. It's just my dad bad at communicating on the internet, and Neil's very good at it. I know him. So I don't know Brian that well. I don't want to extrapolate about Brian, and I don't want to put words in Neil's mouth or say things that have been said in private conversations. But I know that he would – I know how much it took for him to give this to anyone. And so – and I would assume that he knows Brian, or I do know that he knows Brian well enough to trust him and well enough to have that confidence. And so I cannot in any way imagine – that, you know, what you're saying, you know, that, oh, maybe this is Brian and we're just getting to know him. I just can't see that as true.
And I'm literally playing devil's advocate there. Because
yeah, I know. And I met Brian many times as well, but only in a fun, casual way, not enough to know his soul. But I know Neil's, and I know that he wouldn't have done this. Like, it's bizarre. Like, I just don't know. I don't think he really knows either, to be honest. Like, what the hell happened, because he's so wrapped up at the moment in the other stuff that he's doing. But it's insane. I don't even, like, I think, Brittany, did you see, have you gone into the year, the best of posts for the year?
Yes, Hyperbole? I already wrote my blurb to yours.
I put there for you?
Yes, I appreciate your placeholder.
It comes true. Yes, you'll see when the article comes out on Hyperbole. We always do our headlines we want to see in 20, you know, following year, and headlines we don't want to. And I helpfully added one for Brittany that I knew she would put anyway, which is that they return, that Brian and Michael return to American Gods, that it's not that situation is basically cancelled. And I, you know, I still hope that that might happen. I have no idea. They're certainly not filming yet. They were writing and, you know,
Nothing was happening yet.
Yeah.
So
you never know, I guess.
I know. But anyway, that's, you know, end of year, you're thinking about all your favorite things, and then you have your favorite thing and it...
it's ruined.
It gets ruined, because that's how 2017 works.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, that's great. And maybe we could be happy about some other things.
That was a lot of emotion. Okay, Caitlin, let's go to a hype that I'm actually curious to learn more about, because the more I see about this show, the more I am extremely confused, but I hear that it's good. I didn't know there was time travel in this show, despite the title. So please tell us about your feelings at the moment.
Same, now that you say that.
All right. So my hype is Legends of Tomorrow, which is currently my favorite show on television.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite hour of the week when it rolls around. So Legends of Tomorrow is one of the shows in the Arrowverse. Mm-hmm. In season one, they basically said, here are a bunch of the fan favorite side characters of a show.
Ones that had already appeared in Arrow and Flash and stuff, or ones from the comics that people like?
A little bit of both.
Uh-huh.
So it took my favorite, Sarah Lance, took Captain Cold, Wentworth Miller's character, took Heat Wave.
Oh, Wentworth.
Played by Dominic Purcell, so you had your prison break. And they introduced a couple of new characters, and the idea was they were going to get on this time ship and stop this evil dictator from, like, taking over the world, like, 20 years in the future. Okay. And so it was, like, this misfit group of people, and they were trying... So they're going to... Every episode took place in a different era of time, and they're trying to stop it. So season one, I'm just going to say, is terrible. They were hyping up a romance between two characters they introduced for the show. No one liked either of them. their villain is a very good comic villain. They did not translate him well. So basically, there were things that I enjoyed, especially like Sarah Lance and Captain Cold. But mostly the season was terrible. Mm-hmm. Season two, they got rid of all the bad stuff. They got rid of the characters no one liked. They brought in fan favorite villains from the other shows who were not the current villains on the other shows. And completely changed the dynamic. They leaned into the fact that, hey, this is a really goofy, ridiculous time travel show with really obnoxious, crazy, weird people. And leaned into it and became ridiculous amounts of fun. So this show has surprising, is just hilarious.
And this is two now, or this is three?
It's in three now. And so the second season was great. I was really worried about the third season. Third season has been probably even better than the second season. It's just, the whole idea is that it's ridiculous. It's over the top. They still travel through time. The last episode, the mid-season finale that aired last week, featured the team going back to the Viking era where a Tickle Me Elmo knockoff had been discovered, and they decided it was going to be their god. I saw gifts
from this, and I was so confused.
It was Bebo's the god of war.
The blue thing, right? Yes. And I'm like, is that Wentworth Miller? Like, what is this, a fan video? Like, I don't understand what's happening. I saw GIFs with characters that I knew were in Legends of Tomorrow. Or I thought were in, I'm like, is this a spoof? I don't understand what's happening. But I did see the blue thing. So
that's Bebo. He's basically a Tickle Me Elmo knockoff. They had a character who was like going to the store to get it, and like there was only one left, and he like fires a toy arrow to get one off the shelf, and they even play the music that they play in Arrow when the green arrow does something, which is hilarious. And then he gets sent back in time with the toy. The Vikings find this like fuzzy thing that can talk, and they're like, it must be our god. And so are trying to rule, to take over the new world, because they have this Tickle Me Elmo kind of toy called Bebo, and it'll be like, Bebo is hungry. And they say, our god thirsts for the blood of our enemies. And they
this really sounds delightful. It really is amazing.
So that's the kind of ridiculousness that they lean into. They have no self-consciousness about how over the top and crazy they are. And that just makes it so much fun. There are probably plot holes all over the place. And it's so fun that you don't give a shit. Like, no, you don't think about it because it's so
delightful. It sounds like Doctor Who on crack. Like,
yes. You know, like, and Arthur Darvill is in it.
Yeah.
I was gonna compare it to Doctor Who, which I have a lot of issues with.
Yeah, like, but that it just jumps around. Because I know there was that other time travel one that Eric Kripke made, you know, Timeless. And that got resurrected into a second season. I don't know if it's any good. But that was also, because I saw some of the same jokes, like as in like, you know, that like, you know, a black guy was like, what do you think is going to happen to me if I go to this era kind of thing? And I'm like, And then I got confused for a while. I'm like, is that that show or is that that show? And then I realized it was this show.
Yes.
And that show is a lot more serious than this show. It sounds like that seems to take itself quite seriously. Whereas this maybe does not.
Though the show does have the feels. They will surprise you with the feels. Like they recently killed off a character because the actor moved on to Broadway. So they killed the character off, and this episode brought in, it was the episode right after, and they brought in like the younger version of him and like basically gave him a really delightful, lovely send off to like the person he was closest with tried to save his life. And this character was like, you know, I figured out what's going to happen to me and I don't care. I just want to, you know, live the life that I'm supposed to. And I want you to have happiness, this person that I clearly become close to in the future kind of thing. So they will hit you surprisingly with the feels, but overall it's just ridiculous, over the top. They go to crazy places. They'll go to the past. They have, there have been dinosaurs on the show.
Okay.
They have gone to the future. They, you know, they go all over the place. There's magic. There's ass kicking. There are three women on the ship right now, which is amazing. They've got the lead, Sarah Lance, is openly bisexual, and she has relationships with men and women on the show.
That's cool.
They've got the newest member of the team is Muslim. This cast is ridiculously diverse and it's really effortless. It's wonderful. I love everything about it.
Do they meet in the park? Do they do like, is it like Doctor Who? Not like Doctor Who, but is it like, here is Charles Dickens or, you know, whatever. Here is someone in the past, like famous figures and stuff.
Oh, yeah. The Viking episode, they run into Leif Erikson.
The episode really is called Bebo the God of War.
Yes, it really is called Bebo the God of War.
You cover this show, right?
You write about this show. Yes.
What the hell was everyone thinking? What was that when? And I assume you got the episode titles before you got any sort of plot. Like that's common for shows, especially with the CW, that you don't know the plot, but you get you get the titles, and there's sometimes speculation about what the titles mean. What the frick did everyone think this was? Like I just don't understand.
See, with Legends, people mostly just go, it's going to be ridiculous and it's going to be great.
Oh, that sounds delightful. Tell me about Wentworth Miller, because I thought that it was not the same Wentworth Miller.
It is not.
Okay.
They had oh my God, he's played so many versions of this character. The version who appears in season one dies at the end of season one. He sacrifices himself. He goes through this whole big heroic arc that starts on The Flash and ends on Legends. The character, he's popped in, like they've run into him in the past before. And then the version that's currently on the ship, he's going to be there for a few episodes. And this is the last run he's doing with this character. He said that he's leaving there.
So he's not like a permanent, he's not like a regular team member. He's
not anymore. It sounds like Wentworth Miller wanted to be more part-time because the character is and crazy popular. But the character that's on the ship right now is from, they just did the big crossover with Earth-X, which is the Earth that was taken over by Nazis. That version of the character is a freedom fighter on Earth-X.
And he doesn't love a good Nazi AU.
He's gay. Mm-hmm. And he has a partner on Earth-X. Then he decides to come on to the Wave Rider because his version of Heatwave, who is his partner we saw and is Dominic Purcell's character, died on his Earth. So it sounds he wanted to get some closure with the version that's alive on Earth One, which is the one our characters come from. So he's a completely different version and he's like over the top, really nice and kind of sweet, which is hilarious because that's not the version of the character that we initially met. So he's very different, but he's going to be on the ship for a few episodes before he wraps up his run. Wentworth Miller moves on from the Arrowverse.
Well, I hope Wentworth Miller is okay, because I realized a little while ago that he deleted his Facebook, which I loved his writing on his Facebook and his social media, and now he has no social media, and so I'm, unless he's rearranged himself somewhere else that I haven't found yet, but I hope Wentworth Miller is okay.
He posted something about leaving the Arrowverse. It might have been like Instagram or something, but it was on social media. It was saying like finishing recording the last episodes I'm going to do in the Arrowverse.
Interesting. It sounds great. I'm just like very, very quickly scrolling because I was looking at Bebo, the God of War. Is the other thing here that I'm seeing, is that the same thing that I'm, the crossover from another show that was not on this network?
What?
I don't know. It's, I don't care. I'll spoil whoever. I haven't seen the show myself. It says here in the end of that episode that you just watched, the Bebo, that it introduces John Constantine.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the John Constantine of the Constantine that was cancelled?
Yes.
Same actor?
Yes.
I know all about him and Karen and that whole, like, his obsession with... and Karen and Donya and their obsession and his obsession with continuing to keep that character alive in any DC-verse possible.
Yeah, so it was cancelled on NBC. I think WB holds the rights to the character. I'm not positive, but he appeared in a season of Arrow.
Oh, yeah.
He was in one episode. Matt Ryan is voicing Constantine in an animated show on CW Seed, which is where they put their digital stuff. And then he's going to be in a couple episodes on this season of Legends. So they're incorporating the character a bit into the universe.
I have never seen it, but I've very rarely seen someone fight so hard for a character as that actor has fought for that character. And I am familiar with Constantine in the comics. He's also in Sandman. So yeah, that's interesting. So can people watch this without watching the entire DC situation? I know that most people do and want to, but like, is it possible to just follow this because with the crossovers that occur?
I think so. They tell you pretty much what you need to know about the ones that are established, and the others are introduced in the show. So you get more background with the other shows, but it's mostly self-contained because they're just traveling through time. So, and screwing up time. They decided their motto was, we screw things up for the better.
I did not know till very recently that this show was like anything. As I said, I didn't even know it involved time travel. I had no clue, but it sounds delightful.
It's my everything right now. I love it. And I think everyone should give it a shot.
Cool. Yay. All right. So moving on from that, who wants to go next with their everything?
I'm happy to talk about Anne with an E.
Another show that is, self-contained at the moment, that Mitch has been gagging for quite a few months now since the first season came out. So Mitch, tell us about your feelings.
So I can track back a tweet that Natalie wrote.
Oh great.
You wrote, you decide whether or not this is a thing. May 1st was when I read your tweet that then interested me in the show. Natalie,
is the tweet that interested you in the show?
No, well, I already knew what the show was, but I was like, what the fuck's going on with the show?
Okay.
Like, how is it like this? Because I've known about this show for like 5 years, it being the book series, Anne of Green Gables, calling it Anne with an E and making it anything remotely like what you wrote. I was like, did they make this show different? I'm confused. And it is, because it takes place, doesn't it take place like 100 years later than the book?
No.
I could have sworn I did. Regardless, anyone not familiar, And With Knee is a show that has a young whippersnapper of a girl, much like my favorite Lorelai Gilmore, who's trying her best to live on a farm and find a good bay while going to school and doing the farm work and living with good old grandma and grandpa. And it's dramatic and horrible and you'll die, but it's great. So Natalie and I are going to joint take over this one because...
I need to do this with you
because, yes, I have been gagging to talk about this, but I just rewatched some scenes from my favorite character, Gilbert. Gilbert is played very masterfully to the point where you're like, I think you said to me at one point, you're like, how does this child not have an Emmy? Because it is disgusting how minute his performance is, the things he does. They creep me out. It's like he's an adult in a child's body with an amazing presence. He knows how to get your emotions. And that's how we're selling you on the show, the fact that there's this actor here. And I forgot his name. It's Lucas something.
Look, it's Natalie, Lucas Jane Zuman,
please take this.
But there's it's much more than this one character.
It's not,
but he is incredible. It is an adaptation of Green Gables, of the first book of Anne of Green Gables, which I don't know if you don't know.
Yes.
It's, you know, one of the staples of children's literature, certainly the primary staple piece of Canadian children's literature. And it's actually not under copyright. So you can download the entire series for free on like any ebook reader, on like, you know, Aldeco or whatever. But they made a beautiful, beautiful remake of that series. A Netflix, I think it aired on CBC as well or something. But Netflix series of Anne of Green Gables, the first season, which doesn't quite get to the end of the first book, and in fact leaves us on a cliffhanger, but a very very deep adaptation. I know a lot of people are also attached to the old version that came out in the 80s and 90s of Anne of Green Gables. That one, now the older one the timing was wrong, Mitch. The older one was about 50 years later, given the involvement of the First World War. But never mind that.
Oh, really?
So this version seems very, very accurate, both historically. But it's a series that goes deeper than the books ever go. It's a series that adds a lot of realism in a way that books written in that era wouldn't have been allowed to, like stuff about abuse and stuff about, though Anne's abuse is actually pretty textual in the books, especially once she becomes an adult and thinks back on it. That randomly, like about her experience of like getting her period as a 13-year-old girl, you know, the stuff that, you know, young boys and girls would have actually talked about, all sorts of stuff. It goes a bit harder and a bit more real socially while still remaining very, like, it is a beautiful adaptation of the books. It's fantastic series to binge watch. There's only 8 episodes at the moment, which leaves on a cliffhanger midway through one of the books, a cliffhanger that does not occur on screen in the in the book, so it's actually a mystery. The entire show is nearly completely produced by women. Every episode is written by the showrunner, who's a woman, and nearly every episode is directed by a woman as well. There's only one or two that aren't, and I think the second season is all women. Every actor in it is amazing. If you're familiar with Anne at all, like the and Amy Beth McNulty, who plays Anne, is incredible. Marilla is Geraldine James is everything. Like, she's perfect and so much depth.
Oh yeah.
But Gilbert, who is, if you've read the books or if you've seen the TV show, Gilbert Blythe is the boy at Anne's school that she meets, you know, when she's 12, 13, and is sort of her rival and then becomes her friend and then is eventually her husband in, you know, the books span, the entire series of the Anne books spans from her age 10 to age 50 or 60. So, yes, Gilbert is a major factor. This kid who they have playing Gilbert, his name's Lucas Jade Zuman. This kid will win an Oscar in the next 15 years. I nearly promise you. You know, he is so good and it's I don't know. He's the lead in, if anyone saw 20th Century Women. I don't know if you anyone saw that movie with Annette Bening and Elle Fanning and stuff. It's but yeah, he's the young guy who is in that movie that's, you know, about this sort of strange lifestyle with his mother and stuff that he has. But he is the lead he's the lead in that. He is the Anne's opposing male lead in this as Gilbert. And this kid is 1,000 years old. He has...
Oh, it's chilling.
I have very rarely seen a performance like this on television or just in any actor. There's just something about him that is timeless, not like his look and not like his, acting in the era, which is true, but his performance and his... Yeah, his soul, like his inner life is like, I have very rarely seen anything like it. And yeah, I don't know. Mitch wanted me to contribute a bit because I'm very familiar with the Anne series, you know, from my
whole life. Well, because I messaged you, I believe. Yeah. I saw you tweeting about the show and I was like, okay, so is it everything you wanted it to be? And you were like, you were not ready for this. You will never be ready for this. You were so right. I can't handle everything that happens because there's a caretaker that is very openly lesbian, and in this period of time that wouldn't have been as easy as it was, but it shows
I wouldn't say it's open, but it's overt. Like it's if you've ever read the books, there's the Aunt Josephine, Diana Barry's aunt, is Anne has this whole breakdown about love and feelings and all this kind of stuff, and she has her talk with Aunt Josephine, and they are, because at the time you wouldn't have said I am a lesbian, but oh, it is explicitly,
but it's beautiful
clear,
the way it's portrayed,
explicitly clear, yeah, that she was a woman with a long-term life partner, and so there's that, like, yeah, that was a shockingly awesome, you know, little thing to incorporate.
And you didn't mention her getting her first period. That felt fairly revolutionary for television. I haven't seen that in any other show to that extent, to that realism. I don't know. If you could point me to another show that has the same realism as Anne does, I would love it, because these elements, they feel so authentic. Everything that comes about in Anne's life.
I don't watch a ton of shows that are about girls of Anne's age, so I wouldn't know.
The coming of age, yeah.
I wouldn't know too much about that. Like, maybe the others can speak to that about realistic.
Well, no, it doesn't have to be a coming of age story.
But yeah, in terms of the actual period, I don't watch a lot of stuff with girls Anne's age, so I wouldn't have really experienced that. But yeah, there is a level of realism of the human experience in this show that is really incredible, while also being beautiful dream, because that's the way Anne sort of sees the world. And I love this book series, but this show is beyond the wildest dreams. It's the, you know, you could have made a straight adaptation that played things with the tone exactly as it was in the books, and that would have also been fine. Like, it would have been, it's a story that I still love, so I would have been acceptable. They push things in this show in a way I never expected, and I love it. Like, I think it's fantastic. And it's a great binge watch. It's 8 episodes on Netflix at the moment, and the other series two is filming now. But Gilbert, Lucas's Gilbert, is just...
It's unreal.
I just can't say anything more. Like, I cannot remember seeing a performance like it, like with this, especially from someone so young. Like, he's playing about 14, 15 in the show, and he's only about 17 in real life now, maybe. Oh, no, he's only 16 in real life now. Whoops, because he's a very nice-looking kid. But he is 16 years old. He's playing about 14, and he's this kid that has a ton of responsibility because of his sick father and all of that. Oh, this sounds very melodramatic, but this performance...
It is melodramatic. That's the best part about it, because it's like you can sit in their world and you forget about yours, because everything is so the end of the world for them. Everything.
Yeah, but it's
that's still, I mean, that's the way that that's the way they lead, not and that's
played
where, that's
as
where
melodrama. It's played no, as yeah. as just understated in the best way, and it's I don't know. It's yeah. So
it teaches you things you didn't know you needed to learn. Is my other way of going about that because it's like I didn't know I needed to care about all of that. I can't spoil it, and I wish I could so badly because I want to talk about the tiny Gilbert and Anne moments. I really do.
I mean, you can spoil it. I mean, unless
I don't want to because I want people. This is a show. I would spoil The Walking Dead left and right. I would not spoil Anne with an E. It's a much higher quality show. I'll say there's one moment where Gilbert is so sad. I just watched it today over an event, and he is not able to cry because he's exhausted from the experience of it all. But the way that they showed this is they gave this actor nothing to work with. They had him sit and it's snowing. They have a snowflake land in his hand and it falls down like a tear and he stares at it. But it's such a 1,000-year-old stare. It's such a wise look in his eyes and it chills me. That's the best taste I can give you of what this show does.
If you believe in the reincarnation cycle, for example, not that I like actually literally do, but like in terms of mythology, if you believe in the reincarnation cycle, Lucas Jade Zuman is on his last life, if that makes sense as a metaphor. Like if that makes sense as a metaphor, his soul has seen some shit and it comes through in this performance in a way.
But it's the fact that he's kind throughout it.
Yeah.
It's so shocking. Like how can you see so much shit and be so kind on top of all that? Even when you're really angry and you want to like hate everyone because you're 14.
And Gilbert is a likable character, like especially once, you know, he becomes truly friends with Anne as opposed to an antagonist. He's always been a likable character. He's always been a favorite fictional boyfriend kind of thing for lots of people. But this Gilbert is just wow. Like it's just
and he's just one layer. He's one layer of like a perfect cake of this show. This show does not have a boring moment. Every moment you're like, I can't stop. It's because it's so beautiful. You want to see every shot. You want to see how everything is either candlelit or drenched in sun and it's nature and it's beauty and it's animals and it's humans and it's everything you could ever want. Mm. It really is. And they have tea parties.
Yeah, I also love that they've used the theme song rather than doing a little bit of period, you know, diddly-doo music is that they've made the theme song of the show Ahead by a Century by The Tragically Hip, which I don't know, Mitch, if you know the context of this a lot or how much. So The Tragically Hip are like Gord Downie, who was the lead singer of The Tragically Hip, who died a month or so ago. Is basically like the Springsteen of Canada. So he's like the Tragically Hip were kind of like Canada. They didn't make it out of Canada too much. They're known, but not well known. But in Canada, they are a touchstone for everyone who grew up being Canadian, basically. And they are, very, you know, like a poetic band about there's a lot in there about the landscape and like it's patriotic music kind of in a way, not in like a creepy way, but like it is synonymous with Canada. And Gord Downie was the lead singer, and he ended up getting terminal brain cancer a couple of years ago, and they did like a massive big tour. I've actually spoken about that on this show before, I think. Very vaguely because when we were talking about something else, but they did a huge finale tour. They did a huge goodbye tour because he knew that he wasn't going to be able to keep performing and that he was going to die. And the last show like that they did in their hometown was broadcast on the CBC like for free, like, you know, like no ads, like no interruptions. They broadcast the whole thing live. And it was like a moment that stopped all of Canada, and that moment also flooded outside of Canada, at least on like social media and stuff, where people were kind of noticing what was going on in Canada. And for that modern icon of what it means to be Canadian to be used in Anne, which is like kind of the classical literary icon of what it means to be Canadian. And I'm saying this like I'm like a proud Canadian. I've never been to Canada. No, that's a lie. I have been to Canada. But like, no, I just happen to weirdly know this. I don't know why. I just know this.
This is very specific knowledge about Canada. I thought you just knew things like this about America, but.
Gord died a couple of months ago. So yeah, in October. But yeah, this song and the song that they used, Ahead by a Century, is a very popular song of theirs, but it's like their big hit song. So everyone in Canada watching would know it. They playing this would be like you like playing Working Class Man or something as like, you know, like
I was going to say Party in the USA, but I held myself.
Well,
back.
You know, like it'd be playing like a classic song that everyone knew. Working Class Man is an Australian song. Why
Pick Your Fences? So. Yeah, no, I got you.
Yeah, that I randomly just picked an Australian one for some reason. But not one that has any context for you. But the actual lyrics about the girl in the song are incredibly fitting for Anne.
Great. Honestly, I've been meaning to tell you to watch it for the Lorelai Gilmore feel. It's like if Lorelai Gilmore, this is horrible, was horribly abused as a child and neglected and still maintained her peppy attitude, but then had a
Lorelai Gilmore. literally the plot of Gilmore Girls.
and then had extreme emotional breakdowns every episode. It is Gilmore Girls. That's why I love it. Okay, we found it.
Anne's pretty chatty, so yeah.
Oh my god, she's so. If I'm like Lorelai Gilmore, I'm even more like Anne to a disgusting degree. And it's sometimes where I'm like, I would have a breakdown over a boy looking at me in the wrong way in the same exact way. Like I would cry for like a month. And
what they do with Anne is very interesting to me because Anne, if anyone's ever read it, would be aware that she's very flowery, she's very fantastical, and she kind of talks ridiculously. And in the books, that's not really addressed. That's just like, oh, that's just who she is. It's sort of subtext, but it's just who she is. In this, it makes it very, very, very clear that behavior is a coping mechanism. And that is really, really interesting to me as well, and it makes it like much less annoying. Like if you took Anne on as base level, she would be very annoying, but there is so much to it, especially in there is so much, like those books are being really analyzed. That analysis is being found before this show, but this show just really nails it in an amazing way. So anyway, Mitch, it was Mitch's hype, but he asked me to participate.
No, and I wanted to do that. I needed that.
I love this show. I love everything about this show. And definitely,
I wouldn't dare talk about it without you because it wouldn't do it justice. Because, like, my birth of this show for real came from you. Like, my reference to it is that the voice actress of Cora, I listened to her podcast.
Janet Varney.
She talks about Anne with an E religiously because it was what she grew up on.
Really?
Oh, yes. She references it in every single episode to every guest because it always relates because it's always about, I wish I could be like Anne growing up next door and then having all of the, like it's such a staple for her life. So I understood it to be an American thing, even for not just Canadians, but also for.
Yeah, of course. Yanks, well, see, so. They're world famous. Like books are world famous. I've read them since I was a child as well.
And then I think when you were watching it, I was like, all right, if Natalie's watching it, I can get in on a good thing here. If I start now, we'll see what kind of wild ride we'll get in on. And because if I see such fantastical tweets as I did from you on a show, I'm like, okay, this is what I'm jumping in on now. If it's short, if it's 8 episodes, I'm doing it. So if that didn't pitch it to you, I don't know what
will. And I actually watched it week to week when it was airing. Like I illegally
You had to wait?
I had to wait. I watched
this
it week
is not
to
the
week
show you
before
wait
it
on.
Came on Netflix. So you've got it on Netflix now, which is great. But I did watch it week to week when it started.
Because you'll think you're watching it when you sit down to watch it. You'll think you're watching a very calm, very slow-moving show, but you're not. You're actually watching like very high drama.
It's
and very,
very
well produced.
Full. It's very full.
And it's not a middle school show. You don't have to be a child to enjoy it. You probably shouldn't watch it if you're a child at all.
Oh, no. It's an adult show about a character that is a child. Full
yeah, it's
100%
it's, sure. it's meant to be reflecting on the adults raising her and how difficult it is to bring in an orphan. And it's very much an adult show. So don't be scared by the fact that there are like 12-year-olds starring. it's way beyond that. And because they casted it, as Natalie said so wonderfully, you won't even care or notice. You'll be so into it. You'll love it from the first soliloquy of whatever beautiful thing Anne sees out there. She'll go on, but you're listening to this, so you'd like
to go on. This is the moment where Brittany or Caitlin's like, yeah, I watched it and I hated it. But yeah, I hope
try it. Please do tweet Natalie and I so you can join our trash club, because we need more Gilbert
as well. Trash. Brooke is a huge, huge fan.
Yeah. So Brooke likes it a lot.
It's trying to get high on this train. It's great.
So come be trash with us. It's a great
love
world.
Love this, you know, 1800s. Yeah. Canadian. Yeah.
So thank you for doing that joint hype with me, Natalie. I really appreciated it. I know, as you said, I've been gagging for the Gilbert talk, and I got it. I finally got out my snowflake tear.
I hope it feels like you've
I deserved it. Okay, I waited. That was like a 6 month build.
It's true. All right. Okay. Sorry about that. That felt like a lot. I assume either of you guys have not watched this, or have no interest in this, or have possibly watched it and hated it.
I haven't watched it.
I would recommend it to everyone. I think it's fantastic. It's so good that I don't want to write about it. I just want to have it near me. But yeah, so good. And great binge watch if you want to watch it over the holidays for anyone. Anyway, so my hype I said that, you know, my gripe was The Greatest Showman. My hype is the real current greatest showman on earth, which is Harry Styles and his solo career. Because this, I just got to see Harry last weekend? 2 weeks ago. I got to see Harry play a solo show, his first solo show in Sydney at the venue, my local theatre-sized venue of like 1,600 people or so, which is maybe 2,000 people, which is the venue that I used to talk about him playing as a joke a few years ago when I was like, yeah, I really want him to have like an indie solo project to play like the Enmore Theatre or something, like as a joke that would never happen. It happened. And it was amazing and just so fantastic. And I don't really need to tell you Harry's entire history. I've written articles about it. I've spoken and tweeted and tumbled about it. And honestly, you know, and there are much smarter, better music writers that have also expressed a lot of things about Harry's history, particularly my favorite music writer, Rob Sheffield for Rolling Stone. And Harry is my favorite person in the public eye, basically, like in terms of the amount of power he holds and how he chooses to use it. You know, the power he holds as a young, attractive white man who is the focus of the real hype, the real teen hype, you know, huge, biggest celebrity, you know, pop star. Because there are lots of people in the public eye who we love, who we know are cool. Like, we wouldn't assume anything. We wouldn't assume anything other than that from, I don't know, your people that we know are have no reason to be anything other than chill and progressive and stuff like that. But you know, your pop stars, your for the lack of a better word, your manufactured pop stars, which One Direction obviously did start out as, are a real wild card who, you know, are not really always a bastion of social responsibility. Harry Styles is the greatest person in the public eye for what he shows people to be as a role model, as a man, like as an example of what it's cool to be as a guy, of what girls should want from a guy or guys should want from a guy, and what guys should want to be like to be a, you know, a healthy, good, comfortable person. Everything he puts out into the world is just beautiful and careful and brave and, you know, I mean, you've seen him, like you've seen how he dresses and how he behaves. Like he's not, he's like the best of glam rock. He's the best of a David Bowie or a Mick Jagger or something like that, while also being like in terms of his, I'm going to wear what I want. I don't care. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be progressive about sexuality. I'm going to do whatever. He's all of that without their fuck you attitude about it, without their, yeah, this is a rebellion. That, you know, he'll get in Rolling Stone and say, yeah, you should probably pay attention to what teen girls like, because have you noticed how that's like a really important thing in how society has continued to move and like stuff like that. He is the wokest bae and I adore him for it. He's his, all of his merch,
the wokest bae.
All of his merch, literally his slogan on all of his merch is just treat people with kindness. Like you can, like I have a lapel pin, doesn't say Harry Styles, doesn't say anything else. It's just a enamel lapel pin that says treat people with kindness, and he has a shirt and stuff like that. That's his merch. Like it's absurd. And so he is making bank of teaching people how to be nice to each other. And I love it so much. And he's so wonderful. I just, I just adore him. But seeing, and his album is perfect. His solo album is perfectly to my taste. It is exactly the kind of music that is like, I liked One Direction because I liked them and I listened to their music because I was like, this is the music that these people who I appreciate are making, as opposed to the music being what drew me in. Harry's music is exactly the kind of music that I like as music. It's like, again, this rock, slightly glammy classic rock style, and I'm just mad about it. And the performance, his concert that he gave was so, so good. He's so funny. He's so chill. It was the day or a couple of days after or a week or so after the marriage equality vote came in Australia. And a big thing with all like Harry's entire solo tour, because he just finished the first world solo tour, small venues. Big thing has been rainbow flags or, you know, pride flags. Sea of them at every show, every single show. Has been a sea of pride flags because he has somehow pitched this idea, or it started and ran with it, that, you know, that this was a safe space to be whoever you wanted to be and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of stuff should be rocket science anywhere, but the fact is it's not. And it's something that he's really pushing, something that he's really promoting. Not that he gets on, he's very cryptic. He doesn't get on Twitter and is like, bring flags. It's just something that's developed. And I've honestly been at gay events that I have seen less flags at than looking from the back of this Harry Styles concert. It was a scene of
he's very Woodstocky, it feels.
And oh, yeah, completely. And he'll always grab one or two and, like, play with them and, like, you know, talk about the relevance of, like, you know, being free to express that. And this time there was because we just passed it, he was like, passed the thing, or he said, congratulate, you know, see a lot of, you know, colourful flags here and stuff, and may I say, like, congratulations to your country for, and he was kind of saying, congratulations to you, and he was like, and to your country for finally waking up, and he was really sassy about it. Like, he's very rarely scornful. He's always positive, but this he was scornful about, not to the audience themselves, but to the circumstance that in Australia that had led to what we just had to go through with marriage equality. And I really loved him for that. I loved him for everything. Like, I just love him, and I was so proud to watch him. Stevie Nicks and Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac were both at the same concert as me, because they were both in Sydney for events, and they are very, very fond of him, and they came to his concert in Sydney, and he did a cover of a Fleetwood Mac song, which he always does, but he did it with them there, so that was quite a big moment for him.
What did he cover for your night?
The Chain, and Stevie was filming him on her phone.
Natalie. Oh. And
I love this kid, and he can have not I had dreams for his solo project. I love One Direction. And he's always so positive about that. He's like, did anyone come to see me before with any of my wonderful friends? And like, you know, he'll, you know, he's not like, remember when I did that? Like it's all positive, but his solo project has exceeded every dream I could have ever had for him. And it is beautiful. And Mitch, I know you really love this album. Brittany, I know you've talked about getting tickets as well. So tell me your Harry feels. Show them to me.
Well, I went to see One Direction at the Giants and Jets football stadium here.
Mm.
And I went for free. So disclaimer, totally went for
Midnight
free.
Memories tour, or which tour? Ooh. Do you know?
Without Zane. There was and I sat on the floor, ninth row, and it was they're like so, all of them, like I will speak to all of them first.
They are as well. Agree with anything you say as well.
It was unbelievable. They were so appreciative and
it's nice. So real, isn't it? And like it's so
but then there's Harry, who like you just can't help but watch. Like, he just has this stage presence that was unbelievable. And, like, it was fine. I went. I made a shirt that was, it was a picture of Paul Rudd from his SNL sketch.
I love that.
Yeah. I still have it, so, you know, I might break that out the next time you're here. And he was, like, Dan Stevens, One Direction's number one fan. And then it was, like, this May, end of May, and my brother and I were like, okay, when Harry Styles tickets go on sale, we're gonna get them. And like, you know, then I started panicking because we got the tickets and I was like, oh my god, like the week that we got them for, I'm like, I'm watching our sister's dog in Pennsylvania, like I can't leave and go to New York and then get back in time to like let the dog out after work. I was like freaking out. And then he goes, Brittany, we bought them for June 2018. So I still have plenty of time before I see Harry Styles.
Oh, my God. So you thought you were getting them for June 2017. Yeah, like it was actually June 2018.
2 weeks from the date that we bought them.
Yeah,
no, I had to wait over a year. I'm still waiting.
It'll be worth it. Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I'm really looking forward to it because when his album came out, it was – it was great. I listened to it for a very long amount of time.
I can't wait to see what he does with a stadium because that's going to be real curious because the style is like definitely more of like a club rock.
Yeah, he's at Madison Square Garden, so I'm glad it's not outside. I feel like that would there's such a difference between even just shifting from outdoors to Madison Square Garden, but still. I kind of do think, if it was at a smaller venue.
Yeah. So I had the club show, and then in April I'll be seeing him on the same tour as you are. So the world tour, the full stadium tour. And, oh, I love that he wanted to do the club show tour first because he could have done bigger. You know, he could have sold out that show. He could have sold out a bigger tour. He could have sold out more nights. He could
And I mean,
he could have gone bigger.
Pardon? The Killers, before every tour, they do a bunch of club shows and I saw them, so like they're playing here in January and they just started in their bigger arena tour. They started at the O2, but I saw them at Terminal 5, which is a much smaller, tinier venue, and I would never ever see them anywhere else. Like I will never go to a stadium tour for them because that was like the most I get what why Harry is doing it. It's just such a more intimate show.
Like, his first shows, his very first shows as a solo artist were tiny. Like, he played The Garage in London, which I don't know if you are ever familiar with in London, but it's where it's actually where Darren Criss played after the Glee tour in 2011. So I think Darren Criss popularity in 2011, it's, like, not a massive venue.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? Like, that's where Harry did his solo show, his first solo show in London. And like that's like no barricade, like sweaty. It's like, and he's done the Troubadour in LA as well. His first solo like tiny little you know experiment was it like a very it was the Troubadour or the Roxy? No, I think it was the Troubadour in LA. So yeah, he's got all of the money. Harry has all of the money. He doesn't need money. He is doing things on his own terms more than I ever would have dreamed he would ever be allowed to. And I'm so glad that he is. Like, certainly he's moved away from like the first management he had. He's with the management company now that is like, he's really good friends with them. Like he like met people, and then I think the son of like someone who's quite a famous agent made his own management company, and that person is really good friends of Harry, and Harry moved to that management company. His guitarist is a kid he pulled out of a pizza shop, like, who's like clearly like, what is my life? Like he met a kid, like I think when they were doing their first sessions, the first guy cancelled on them, and someone was like, oh yeah, I've got this friend Mitch who can like play. His name is Mitch, by the way, Mitch, who can play really well, and he could come down. And so Mitch, who was working in a pizza shop at the time, was like, I guess I'll come in and help. Didn't know the context of Harry, came in, found out. Harry fell in love with him and kept him on. And that Mitch has a co-write on every song on Harry's album. It's Harry and Mitch. It's the Jagger and Richards. And so Mitch, who had never recorded in a studio before meeting Harry Styles, who was a casual guitar player who worked in a pizza shop, is now a millionaire because Harry has given him writing credits on every song on the album. He's just doing it. He's just doing it the way he wants, in a way that I've never seen a pop star do. And I'm sure some of them have, you know, in different times, or there's people whose stories I don't know as well as I know Harry's, but I'm so happy and proud about it. I just love it. I think, and Brittany, you're going to love the concert. And he's just amazing. Like he's just doing it all right. He's just everything, like the actual music, the effect of his words, you know, what he's putting out there as a public figure is just, I would die for this kid. I would kill for him. Like maybe not literally, I don't know, but I would do a lot. I would do a lot for this kid, and he is just wonderful. And Natalie, I'm so happy to see the concert.
Do you think we can give a dual recommendation on a song here from The Dining Table, that song?
Oh, if you want to. Yeah, Mitch a while ago in this, well, he was like, I want to do an episode about Harry Styles. I need to talk about From The Dining Table. So, yeah, the closing song on the album.
God. It is unfair. If you want to have, like, I don't care if you never even had a relationship, to have a breakup in the first place. We described it together as like the most ripping heartbreak. Like the way that this song builds, it's maybe one day you'll call me and tell me that you're sorry too. It builds and it builds. I could tear up right now just thinking of it. I haven't heard it in months because I refuse to listen to it. If you want to see the depth of this man's emotion, just look no further than the song From The Dining Table, because you will die a thousand deaths. It is so extreme. I've listened to some tough Taylor Swift songs, okay? I know, whatever. But sometimes she gets me. This gets me further than anything else ever has in a song. It's great, but it's horrible. So you're going, you'll be miserable, but you'll be happy about it. So enjoy, world. We gave you this recommendation. Try it out. If you cried, you're welcome. If you didn't, you suck. So go try.
Wow.
Yeah. You need to cry at this song. You do.
But even putting out Sign of the Times as a first single, I wrote about
this. Oh, my God, that song.
I wrote an article about this, and I never write about Harry, and I never write about music. But this came out, and I was like, I'm going to have to write about that. And this is massive. That even that as a first single is like, you don't put songs like that on the radio. Like, he changed the game. Like, he made them play to his tune, because he did not write something that was going to be a hit. He wrote something that is the antithesis of a radio hit. And he was like, that's my first single. I'm Harry Styles. If you want Harry Styles' first single, that's it. And
can I tell you now?
And it worked. And I love that. And it's not done with, he knows his power, but he's not a dick about it. And that's very cool. Like, he knows,
so many people in my life came out of the woodwork with that song out of nowhere. Like,
what, to be like, oh, actually Harry Styles.
No, like they were like, they're like, I know Harry Styles, but this is Harry Styles. And yeah. I would look at them and be like, dead face. Like, yes, this is Harry Styles. Because it was like, a lot of people were like, okay, I know One Direction, but now I need to follow Harry Styles. I'm like, yes, you do.
Well, and I said this when I wrote my thing. I'm like not to gatekeep or anything, but anyone who really knew One Direction and really knew Harry as a fan, this was not shocking. Like, it's that, so it slightly pisses me off where people are like, oh my God, I had no
idea. That was the only reaction I had from people.
If you had, if you had no idea, then you clearly didn't know anything about them before, which is fair. I guess some people don't. But I did see a lot of like, Harry Styles is cool now. And I'm like, no, I'm going to stop you right there. No.
Okay. So
he was always like this. You were just not aware of it. So
I became aware of him when he dated Taylor because I'm a big Taylor Swift fan. So then I looked into him and I was like, oh my God. And then you would talk about him and I'd be like, oh, and then Sign of the Times came out and then the world caught up to us. And I was like, okay, come on. Like, get with the Sign of the Times, I guess. Like, he's a thing. He'll be around for a while. And oh my God. Okay. Well, for one little tiny anecdote, I have to say that also, if you wanted to get into a little bit more of this kind of emotional, mushy gushy One Direction stuff, This Town by Niall Horan is also very amazing.
Niall's solo projects, it's nice. He's got a good.
It is.
Yeah, Niall has a more of an acoustic, folky.
He does.
Thing. He's good. And I love Louis as well. I actually love Louis' pop stuff that he's putting out with like EDM and stuff. I think it's a really good fit.
There are a lot of good things coming out of One Direction because they were cultivated for a reason. So start with Harry and see where you go from there. But you cannot go wrong if you start with him because there's too much good going on in that album. It's the
definition of good music to me in every way. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's my Harry feelings. I really feel like his album, which is Harry Styles by Harry Styles, it's the pink one. He was originally going to call it the Pink Album, like how the Beatles have the White Album and stuff like that, but they changed their mind. So,
I would have loved the Pink Album.
But yeah, they were originally going to call it that. But anyway, I love Harry. He makes me so happy, and I'm glad to have seen this concert.
I'm still in shock and really awe. Good. And why can't really I be good. You? Ugh, I'm dying.
Well, one day. Mitch, one day we should go to a Harry show. Everyone should go to a Harry show together. Honestly, even the One Direction show that Brittany mentioned, like every time I've gone to a One Direction show, and I've been 6 or 7 times, it felt like the environment of the crowd, the environment of everyone there. It wasn't like a crying hysteria, like, oh my God, everyone's like, going crazy. It was much purer happiness. Like it's kind of like, I don't want to say like everyone's in on the joke because it's not a joke, but it's a feeling. It's a real feeling of it feels small and familial, even in a stadium. And that's absurd. Like the way they act, the way everyone acts about each other, the way everyone knows them so well, like that's a big, big part of why they have so many fans, is because they are so well known. There's no like mystique about who the guys are. Like I'm sure there's lots of things that are private, but
yeah,
big part of them is them being very well known. Like and so it felt like watching like, your little brothers who you're proud of or whatever.
It does.
Anyway. Anyway.
Even from afar, I can feel that. Yeah.
Moving on. So that's my hype. Harry isn't always hype though, but I did just see the concert the last weekend of November. So yeah.
I genuinely wanted to hype just that song, but I think I've calmed down since.
Cool. All right. So yeah, that's where we're at. Brittany, how about you? Aside from obviously your shared, potential passion for Harry Styles.
Well, I'll go back. My passion that has lasted 18 years, and that passion is SpongeBob. So, SpongeBob, for the past, 4 years, I've been stressing about a particular aspect of the SpongeBob universe coming together and existing in New York City, and that is the SpongeBob Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
It is a thing that now exists and I have seen, and
oh boy,
it is wonderful.
Okay, good.
Okay. So SpongeBob started in Chicago and there were pictures coming out of that production and when a show, as Natalie is well aware, and most of you are too, when a show does an out-of-town run, it's going to probably change sometimes in major ways, sometimes in not so major ways. The costumes aren't final. The sets aren't final. The book isn't really final. The musical numbers aren't really final. SpongeBob had a little bit of a difference in terms of music being final because SpongeBob was written in a very interesting way. So Kyle Jarrow was brought onto the project for SpongeBob. He was the book writer. And what he did was he wrote the story, what's going to happen on stage in these 2 hours that you're going to spend with the SpongeBob cast. So he wrote that and had to work with Nickelodeon and the director Tina Landau to come up with this. Like, so basically I spoke with Kyle for Hypeable last week, and actually, oh my God, it was this week. I have to keep reminding myself of that.
Time is just a mess.
Yeah.
I did not realize it had been this long since we recorded as well. Hence the everything in this last 6 months of this year has just been absurd. Like, it's just been insane. I don't understand. So please.
So this week, I spoke to Kyle Jarrow, who wrote the book for SpongeBob, and I kind of, my first question, because it was the one I was most interested in, was like, what came first, the book or the music? And the book came first. So he pitched a bunch of ideas to Nickelodeon, the craziest of which he said was that the town of Bikini Bottom, where SpongeBob is set, is going to be faced with this apocalyptic event. And what better situation could you put the eternal optimist of SpongeBob in than the end of the world? Like, how does an optimist face the end of the world? So they did that, and they wrote the book. And then what they did is they left holes in the story and basically just said, song about X goes here. And that's all they did. Mm-hmm. Then they took that book and reached out to some very interesting people, including the Plain White Tees, T.I., Panic at the Disco, David Bowie has a song in here, Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, The Flaming Lips, Aerosmith, Lady Antebellum, John Legend, They Might Be Giants. All of these people have songs that they wrote for the SpongeBob musical, and their songs are in the show right now. I just read that list of names from the playbill.
Yeah, I think the Bowie one, from my knowledge, I think the Bowie one is an existing song.
It is an existing song.
They got permission to rework, but most of the other ones are original, right? It's like an actual song that Panic at the Disco wrote for SpongeBob, you know.
Yes, and I need a video of them performing this song because it's my favorite song from the whole musical. It's called Panic. Simple Sponge, and it's so fantastic. Yeah. So,
does it feel hodgepodge, though, with all those different authors and artists?
No. So that's what I asked. So the soundtrack, again, came out right before it opened in previews on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
And I listened to it straight through, and that was the first thing I picked up on was, this works. It's weird, and every song is different, but it works. And the characters, the people who they have cast in this show, Wesley Taylor as Plankton, you would not know.
Wes Taylor is in it?
He is. Natalie, he's
oh
so
my
incredible.
God, I did not know that. How long is it going to run for?
It's going to run for, I'm going to say hopefully.
Till May?
Oh, probably. I would think it'll stay open.
Oh my God. Okay. Oh my God.
I will see it with you. Don't worry. he is a very big part. He raps because he's Plankton, and it's amazing. I listened to it first before I saw it, and I'm like, these characters, these actors have nailed the voices. It is crazy. Like, if you're just listening to the soundtrack, you would think that you're listening.
You would think it's the voice actors from the TV.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Then the set is incredible. It takes over the whole theater. There's this, like, Rube Goldberg, like, machine that like sends giant beach balls around the theater down onto the stage. It's like this, there's a guy whose only job is to sit on stage and he makes the sound effects in real time. So whenever SpongeBob takes a step, he makes it squeak.
Like, oh my God.
There's so much attention to detail in this show that it's like, you don't even know that you're like watching real people. And my friend texted me the other day because she saw my article go up and she goes, wait, like this, they're played by real actors. And I'm like, what did you think? It was like Disney on ice. Like, you know, like, yeah. And there are hilarious little nods to like Plankton being played by a real size person when he's supposed to be tiny. There's a little Plankton doll. It's really funny. But like, they don't leave anything out. There are jokes in there that are like for people who have seen every single episode of SpongeBob.
I have really not though. Really,
but you don't have to. You just have to be aware of SpongeBob as an entity, I think.
Yeah.
But like I said, like it's for the diehard fan and for the not so familiar fan, which like you're not losing anything because you don't know things. But if you do know the show inside and out, like my brother and I do, we had people sitting in front of us, turning around, looking, glaring at us because we were laughing. I've never laughed so hard at anything. It's a real treat. So
is it filling the Groundhog Day hole?
Nothing can. No.
Sorry to bring back that memory.
God, all right. You want to get back into gripes? Let's talk about Groundhog Day, Chloe. It's a very different show, and it means something. Whereas Groundhog Day caught me off guard, and I wasn't prepared to love it. This, I was like, I've been so nervous about for so long that it's this immense relief of it working and being good. And it's just the passion in the show of all the actors. Like, there's the guy who plays Squidward, Gavin Lee. Mm. He has an extra set of legs built into his costume that, like, you can watch clips online, like, that bend when he walks so it looks like all four legs are walking just like Squidward would. And he does a phenomenal tap number in that costume. Like, it is unbelievable. And like, you're listening to the soundtrack and you're like 95% of the way through and you're like, where the hell is the tap number? This is a Broadway musical, there has to be a tap number. And Squidward starts singing and I'm like, oh duh, of course it would be Squidward's song. Squidward's the theatrical performer. Of course he would have this show-stopping name and lights tap number. And it just, everything about this show works. And Ethan Slater, holy cow, he plays SpongeBob. He is the most, first of all, flexible human being I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, to where, like, are you actually a sponge? Because
leaning on his hips, right? Like, he does the going around town. I've seen that, I think.
Like he has to like go through this whole like contraption thing and towards the end of the show, and like the way he can bend his body, like I would not know how he does two shows a day in that. Like, it's very physically demanding for him.
I bet he's a yogi. It makes sense if he was to do yoga to get that flexible. Yeah, that strong.
I mean, he's also been playing. He is the original person they went out to for SpongeBob. And so he's been with the show since it was being written when he was still in college. So he has been there from.
Did the guy know? Like, why were they like, this is the guy that needs to be SpongeBob? Like, do you know?
I think they saw him in a production and they just brought him in to read the parts, like at a reading, and that was it. Like, he was SpongeBob, and he can do the SpongeBob voice like so well that it's terrifying. Like, to watch him do the SpongeBob voice, like to watch him do the laugh, it's freaky. Like,
the original guy moves his throat with his hand, doesn't he? Or does
yes.
he? So does this guy have to do that as well?
He can just do it.
No.
Yeah, he can just do it. It's really weird. He doesn't do it a lot during the show, thank God, because I would freak out.
But does so SpongeBob is a pretty musical show as is. Like, it has musical episodes even, and it has like just songs in it. It's kind of like Family Guy. But does it feel like it's its own unique entity, or do the songs feel like F is for Friends and like Best Day Ever? Like, what kind of vibe do you get? Is it anything in the show's universe? Like, I'm still not sure where to place this. And,
well, there is a song called Best Day Ever, which is fantastic.
Is it the same one?
No, it is not. So
interesting.
It does feel very every song is very SpongeBob. There's a song called Daddy Knows Best, and that's like Mr. Krabs like singing to Pearl. Oh, by the way, the actress who plays Pearl she's 18. She has the most incredible voice I've ever heard in my entire life. She is just a knockout. I love her. But every song fits the character and also fits the world. Like, they all feel like when you walk in, they're playing like that luau-y type music. And like, so you're instantly just like in the world of Bikini Bottom. And then, but every other song, like whether Sandy singing or Patrick and, SpongeBob have a song called BFF by the Plain White Tees. That's very Patrick and SpongeBob. Patrick ends up getting worshipped by the Sardines, and they have a song like that's like a huge gospel number where they're just like obsessed with him, and it's very eclectic, but SpongeBob's eclectic. So like, you're not going to hear Striped Sweater next to, you know, when they're doing Band Geeks. So you know what I mean? Like, it's like those two episodes would, if they played back to back, you wouldn't think anything of it. So you have these songs playing back to back, you're not going to think it just works. It's like little 11-minute snippets of an episode that make up a whole story.
I have one favor to ask of this musical. Does it give an ode to My Whitey Tidies? Because that song has amazing chords, and it's weird that it does, but I love it. I love it so much.
As I said before, all original music for this musical, you're not going to hear.
Well, I know that, but does it have anything that's similar in that?
No.
Vain. I love that song. It's so good for SpongeBob, like being just a cartoon. You're like, okay. But then you listen to songs like that and you're like, holy crap, Nickelodeon.
Yeah, no, it's very original to itself. It doesn't play on anything that's been written for the show before.
That must have been a big discussion for them.
What about the actual theme song?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that is the final encore.
Curtain call?
Yeah, it's the curtain call, and where everyone just loses their crap. Yeah. You can watch, there's plenty of videos, I think, on Instagram of it, because it is the curtain call number from opening night. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
I heard a snippet of like the Bikini Bottom Day song, and that one sounded like it had some great structure. I was pretty chilled when I heard it.
Yeah, Bikini Bottom Day is the longest song. It's the opening number. And it's fantastic. I heard it and I was sitting at my desk and I'm like, don't freak out, don't freak out, don't freak out, don't freak out, don't freak out. So it was,
I'm going to listen.
Yeah. It's very, very good. You can listen. I would recommend just listening to the musical. One thing about it though, like that I talked to the writer Kyle about, was this musical was written 5 years ago in a very different time in the world. And the book really hasn't changed that much. But the things that they touch on, like, seem ridiculously relevant now.
Yeah. I can imagine. Like,
yeah, the end of times, the spreading of false information, picking on people because they don't really belong in the underwater land, like Sandy the squirrel. You know, it's very weird. Like, you know, he goes, I don't know if you picked up on this. And I'm like, yeah, I did. So like the show is really about like what all of these people do with their own internal fear, knowing that the end of the world is coming. Like Plankton puts a plan into action. Mr. Krabs wants to protect his money and make a quick buck. And SpongeBob is trying to save everyone else before himself. And, you know, like it's all about this deeper exploration of fear, which I don't think that Kyle was ready to talk about. He was like, whoa, you really picked up on that. And like, we had like this, we talked for like over a half hour about just SpongeBob in general and how great it is.
In person or on a call?
On the phone.
But he's here in New York?
Yeah, he was in New York. He's in LA now filming a show that he has on CW. Mm. But he was in New York because I talked to him the morning of opening night.
Wow. How did you... I'm not even going to talk about that later. That's... I'm very happy that you got to do that. That's kind of insane. That you
yeah, it is. To Holy crap.
Did you chase that or was that found for you?
I got an interview from his PR person about his CW show. And I was like, okay, but listen, I really want to talk to him about SpongeBob. So when the show goes into previews, I plan on seeing it pretty early. Do you think that that's something we could work out? And they held the interview until I was able to see it. So I saw the show and then I interviewed him.
You saw it in previews and you interviewed him after you saw it.
That's amazing. God,
I think I saw this come by, but I didn't know like the relevance of him to SpongeBob. So
yeah, it was like, so I asked his PR person, Taylor, I was like, hey, listen, is there any way I can maybe shift this more towards SpongeBob? And then I like brought up Valor at the end as a courtesy.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, cool. See SpongeBob so I don't have to deal with another heartache like Groundhog Day, because listen, I'm just too fragile.
She can't take it twice.
I really can't take it.
I take it SpongeBob though, we'll have to succeed. It's SpongeBob.
Yeah.
Broadway is it's impossible fickle. To predict.
Yeah. That feels like it's an in, like it has to win. I know you're like saying Charlie that, but still.
Factory's closing.
That oh, one I really? Don't. Yeah, I think SpongeBob is more of a staple, honestly, than Charlie. I think it's still ongoing and it still has an interest.
I mean,
young
Charlie
and older
wasn't,
now.
Charlie wasn't good.
Well, that's the thing. Like, this is good too, so that's what keeps it going.
But then things are good, but people never get in the door. Like, it's all very difficult.
Yeah.
It's,
I hope it succeeds for you, Brittany.
Worst genre to be a freaking super fan of. It's so annoying. But
it often hurts.
Anyway. Oh, this has been long, but I feel like very invigorated about life and the universe.
Has a weight been lifted off your chest? Because we had a lot cooking for this.
So, okay. So we're gonna move on very swiftly to close up this episode. And hopefully everyone's had a fun time just chatting about how they feel, which is what we're here for. Two truths and a lie I'm going to do. And then Brittany is, we've got a question of the day, which I actually do have. I should copy and paste that in. And then we are going to finish. So two truths and a lie. Okay. So I'm going to ask, I've been renovating my house, right? And I, so I've got this house that I've bought as of last year, and it's currently undergoing severe renovation. So in the process with, as I mentioned in the other episode of Rewatchable with Jim Firmstone, my builder, here I'm going to tell you three things that have been discovered about the house, two of which are true and one of which is a lie. Okay. So let me make sure I've got this in the right order.
I love that we're coming back to Jim. This is so full circle.
Jim is going to be a regular feature. So,
on the podcast when you're done with
it? I would not say no.
I thought you were going to be like, absolutely not, but that took a turn.
I would not say no. Okay, so things that have been discovered while renovating this house. Number one. Because this house is really, 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 really weird. Number one, throwing back to our Buffy discussion about drywall, that the kitchen has been drywalled a few inches in, creating a waste of space a few inches wide on top of a finished brick wall that would have never had to have been drywalled in the first place. That's number one. Number two, that the windows in the upstairs bedrooms are 4 to 5 layers of window frame thicker than they need to be therefore all of those need to be dismantled in order to get a window in the correct size, or the biggest possible size, because people have gone layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. And number three, that there are white ants or termites in the wooden floors that have to be ripped up. So one of those three things is a lie. Which one is a lie?
I want to say the drywall one, because we were talking about building and in Rewatchable with brick versus drywall, and I think that that was just on your mind and you were able to make that up pretty quickly.
Oh, so,
I'm going to stick with drywall.
As sound logic as that is, I'm going to hope that the termites is the lie, because God help you if that's true.
I'm going to say the windows.
Okay, so the lie, unfortunately, the drywall's true. And it's pissing me off so badly because I'm going to have to, it's going to make me want to pull it all out. Like, it's a finished drywall, but it's 3 or 4 inches deeper than the wall on the other side. Like, so it's like you've got an unnecessary waste of space and we don't know why. The windows is true. Unfortunately, it's layers. Whoever renovated this house in the past has done layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of absolute insanity. And then the white ants, the termites in the floors, is not true. Unfortunately, on the downstairs level of this house, there are actually no wooden floors. It's a concrete floor that's going to have floors replaced. But there are, as I've discovered today, apparently white ants in the ceiling of the bathroom, which is luckily getting ripped out anyway. I really hate parasites and really find it very difficult to deal with. So I'm really a bit paranoid about that. So,
yeah, but you have your gym to care of that.
I have my gym, and Jim's estimated quote for this entire job, or that he's ballparking it, is half of what the first building company that was being complete weirdos with me was originally predicting.
It's so, because he's Jim.
I feel confident overall, but yeah, it's been time. So lots of house wankering to come.
Yes, Natalie, I need to tell you my one house wankering thing, and I'll keep it in the span of one sentence. Okay. I was lucky enough to have a trim painting that's a trim paint that's white match exactly my bed frame, which was very nicked and is from the 40s. And I painted it white perfectly, and you cannot see the difference of where I freshly painted and where I hadn't. And it looks fabulous, and I died. It was just the dumbest of all dumb luck.
Is it the bed frame that you found? Like, did you get this on? Yeah,
the Craigslist one I had from way back when. So that's the house wanker update. I've been dying
like
to tell you.
Like a solid timber.
Yep. Yeah, it is, and it looks new. Like
Why don't you send me a picture?
I took pictures, so I will. Okay. I'll send them to you. And I have a picture of the authentic 1940s tag on it that displays who it was getting delivered to.
So cool.
Yeah. It really blew my mind that the paint was like perfect. And I was like, oh my God, Natalie's going to love this.
Okay.
Like, what are the chances? Come on. That's unfair.
I am very excited. And I'm just thinking about all the things I'm going to have to sand. We have a question of the day from Leah. So her @ is @ Leah TA11. And she's given me one super heavy question and one super light question. Do you want light or do you want heavy?
I think in this day and age in general, we need light.
Okay. How many tabs do you have open at the moment?
For half of this podcast, I was working on two computers. So the computer that is now closed had many, many, many tabs open, but the computer I'm currently using only has 3.
That's decent.
Well, because I'm going to literally go to bed as soon as we're done, so I've been closing out of things.
I have mainly stuff on the computer. I have mainly stuff relevant to this podcast. I have the Facebook group this podcast with our passwords. I have Twitter. I have my Hyperball email account because I was just searching something. I have our Tumblr page. I have our document. I have all of things that we've been Wikipediaing, like Legends, Kyle Jarrow, and I've got all of these Wikipedia pages open. So not that
I could
many.
Sense out that you had the IMDb pages up for a lot of shows too. You must have
not that many. Not that many on the computer. On my phone, it's probably on my phone. It's 12 on one device and about 30 on the other.
Oh God!
And the ones on the other device, it's like Sydney tap and bathroom wear, exposed shower set Australia, Broadway window lever exposed shower, old fashioned taps Australia, Savoy Edwardian baths Australia, Victorian plumbing, like it's all that. It's all bathroom equipment and fan fiction. So it's like 50% AO3 tabs and then 50% bathroom stuff on my Samsung phone that I carry around like as a mini tablet almost.
Those percentages,
use of my internet on.
Natalie, those percentages are exactly how I would create a Natalie if I needed to.
Yeah, it's literally that's what it is. So yeah, that's quite fun.
Half house winker, half fan fiction.
Caitlin, how about you and your tabs? Do you have many messy tabs or do you have a very organized system?
I have two tabs open right now.
Okay.
Yeah. I hate you.
I have the show doc and Twitter open. I usually have Facebook and Twitter open at any times. Earlier I had the learning management systems for the schools I teach at because I was putting in attendance and everything because that's pretty mindless. But I, like Brittany, I'm about to go to bed, so I was close.
Yeah, fair enough. Too.
there's one person who will remain anonymous who always posts like Instagram stories of like things that they're working on their computer, and there are so many tabs open that not even the first letter of the page that they're on comes up. And
it gives me serious heart
palpitations.
That would crash my computer. Now I want to work out who that is.
In computer code, we call that triangles. You're like in danger area, you know, like a caution
the
sign.
I've been at the triangle level again, and it makes me very anxious. Like, I'm like, have I forgotten anything here? But it's not.
What if a tab starts playing music? Like, what do you do?
And then you
die.
What do you do? I would just throw my computer out the window.
You mute the whole computer.
Yeah. My God.
Yeah. Hopefully you don't need the audio for anything else. I have 8, some of which are Buffy, Gilbert, Niall Horan, Harry Styles. Mm. And then on my phone, I have, unfortunately, 14. And they're all Craigslist couches, none of which I'm going to buy. But I'm just trying because I couldn't get my couch upstairs for 2 days in a row, and I ended up giving it away for free on Craigslist because I scuffed it up so much. Bought it brand new. Kind of heartbroken. Mm. Like, I want to die because they wouldn't take it back. So that's my life. And the last tab is SpongeBob Whitey Tidy Song so I can listen to it on repeat to fall asleep tonight.
That's not weird at all, but yeah.
No, cool. Listen to it. I'm kidding. Natalie, I kid you not. You will be somewhat amazed. This is not from the dining room table amazed, but this is still like, wow. They put some work into this.
Okay. I believe you. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to finish up finally. We have not forgotten our tradition of closing off with a haiku to end the night. So we'll all say goodbye and then Brittany will read her work, her extreme poetry, and then we'll be gone. So
this is great, Brit.
I'll preempt with a goodbye and thank you for listening if you've tuned back in, and we do hope to continue. If you like this level of nonsense, hopefully there's something in here that you think is worth checking out. So yeah, anyone else want to say anything before we finish?
Hopefully it's not 4 months.
Oh, don't even joke, because it's going to make me very anxious. So
I'll bug you enough.
Circumstances have certainly changed to the degree where I don't think that is the case at all, and I'm very keen to continue this.
Well, now I need to find something else to like really obsess about, because Gilbert has really been it for such a long time, and I don't know how to move on.
We're not circling back. This is how
we're finished. We're done. You'll find something I can tell you 10 hypes a week. I'm excited about something all the time, so you'll find something. Don't worry.
Yeah. I need more.
We'll finish and you'll think of something else.
I will, hopefully. Yes.
Brittany, what have you got for us today?
With the haiku, we're ready for that?
High conclusion.
Okay. Yeah. High conclusion. So today, oh, okay. Whoever was editing covered the whole thing. all right. Harry, gods, legends, Anne, live in a pineapple. This year is a giant mess.
Farewell. But it's almost done.
Goodbye.
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 Goodbye.